Let me just tell you quickly, and there's an amendment, Mr. Chair, the 0502 amendment.
We can't move it yet. Why don't you tell us what that is?
Okay, but if to delete all amendments, just let me tell you.
Sure.
I'm bringing this forward because when my mother entered the nursing home, she had free, or not free drug coverage, but a very minimal plan for my father's United States Steel plan. She'd get bulk drugs mailed from Pittsburgh, and I got Parkinson's, and she takes about 5 or 6 different drugs. Well, when she went into the nursing home finally, the nursing home said they couldn't repackage her drugs, and it wasn't a problem until Medicare Part D got implemented. We had to pick a plan, and they couldn't repackage her drugs from being mailed from Pennsylvania, and so we had to take the Medicare Part D plan, and my mother, when she reached her donor, I think she paid about $6,500 out of pocket when she had a free plan, and there were a number of other people in that nursing home under the same situation. So I introduced a bill to allow the nursing home to repackage it, and there were some concerns by the pharmacists and also by the nursing homes, but I think House File 0502 solves that problem, and there's the representatives from the pharmaceutical or from the Minnesota Pharmacists Association in the audience that helped draft this amendment if you want to talk to them. Otherwise, I don't know of any known opposition. And I think the nursing homes are okay with this language, too.
It's House File 399. We're on the delete all, but we can't move yet until we have a quorum. The chair sees a quorum. The chair moves House File 399 for recommend for pass, and we refer to finance. The chair also moves the amendment A070502, which is the delete all.
Chair, I stand for any questions, or if anyone has any questions for the...
Anyone have any questions for Representative Rukavina? Okay, let's proceed to vote on the amendment first. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, amendment adopted. Yeah. Any questions on the bill? Okay, those in favor of House File 399 as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. Bill's adopted. Thank you, Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome back.
Then I would like to present House File 408, and I have a delete all amendment to that.
The chair moves House File 408.
And Mr. Chair, I have a delete all A070480.
Chair also moves the amendment A070480. The delete all. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Mr.
Go ahead.
Chair, members, and I think this has been worked out with the Department of Human Services. I got contacted last fall or early winter. That the Department of Human Services had said that Centers for Independent Living couldn't serve certain customers that they had been serving for years. We asked why, and we were told that by the department that it was a federal regulations, and so the more that the lady that runs the Center for Independent Living up in Hibbing dug, the more she found out that it really wasn't a federal issue, and we've been working with, these are the clients they've always served. And so we've been working with the Department of Human Services, and I think this language has been worked out by everyone. And with me is Ms. Ruff from the St. Cloud Center for Independent Living. If you've got any questions on the need for this, but I don't think there's any opposition to it that I know of. And I really feel bad bringing a couple bills that aren't controversial in front of this committee, but that's the way it goes.
Why don't we vote on the amendment to the form that the author wants first, and then we'll take questions. The chair moves AO70480. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the ayes have it. Are there any questions for Representative Ruth Davina for the testify? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ruth Davina. It sounds like a fine, I know the senators do like great work. But I'm wondering if on your delete all in section 4, starting on 3.14, has that language been run by the Department of Human Services? Because the intro to it is like list everything that they're going to seek federal approval for, all of our existing programs. And I assume it was to allow Centers for Independent Living to have access to that, but it's written as just that they shall seek federal approval for. Foster care, waiver service, supported employment. I mean, some of those things we already have federal approval for.
Representative Ruth Davina?
I will let Ms. Ruff answer that question.
Ms. Ruff, state your name for the record, and you may continue.
Mr. Chair, my name is Kara Ruff, and I'm the director of the St. Cloud Center for Independent Living and also the president of the Minnesota Association of Centers for Independent Living. When we began negotiations with DHS, writing in strictly Centers for Independent Living, but as the issue grew and we became more aware, we found that it was necessary to include other providers. The department actually, in reference to your question, Representative, suggested this very language that you're referencing as something, a formality that they need federal approval before reimbursements are made.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Council can look at this, but as I'm reading 3.16 to 3.21, I think you maybe need, after on line 3, the Commissioner shall seek federal approval for medical assistance reimbursement of independent living skills services. And then do you want through the, and then have all those listed programs? Because those programs are already approved. We have Community Alternatives for Disabled Waivers. We have all these programs. So I think what you're trying to get at is reimbursement of independent living skills services through the following programs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I can't answer a question. I don't know anything about it. I mean, I'm just trying to solve a problem that these clients, they couldn't serve clients.
Make sure your amendment does what you want.
Right.
Is there someone from the department that might be able to answer that question? State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan McCarthy. I work with the department. And Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, this language is crafted in a way so that we can meet the modified guidelines from the federal government on assuring that there are provider standards in place that address basic health and safety and protection provisions across these programs, and these are different service types in the CADI and TBI programs that we have not, as a state, had provider standards formally and prior to this time.
Representative Loeffler, does that satisfy your...
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to have DHS confirm that you're using this bill as a vehicle to establish provider standards far beyond independent living services. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I think that we need to have an amendment on the title then as well, because this has much broader implications for a whole big range of providers other than just independent living centers. And I don't think most of the providers that would fall under these new requirements would know that this was in this bill then.
Representative Loeffler, do you have some language ready? Or are we, if you like, we could move this on. This is going to come back to Representative Hunley, your committee, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. We've worked closely with the Centers for Independent Living and the Consortium of, for Citizens with Disabilities, the umbrella organization that represents many of the advocacy groups and provider organizations who serve people with disabilities. and they've all been involved. They had a work group established. So I understand your point about adjusting the language, and maybe on page 5, line 8, it would be beneficial to look at, instead of regulating centers for independent living, establishing provider standards for the CADI and TBI waivers, something along those lines. But we have worked very closely with a number of, with all the stakeholders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I would like to move then that the 5.8, the titles, we add where it says regulating centers for independent living and establishing provider standards for MA waivers. And to our witness, it's, even if you've worked with people outside, it really is nice to clue us to when something's a change, and there may be other groups that aren't part of that consortium that would be interested.
Representative Eva.
Thanks. I don't even know what the bill does. I was doing something else. But just from the discussion there and looking at the big scope of this bill, I'm carrying a bill for Representative Lesh tonight, the another committee. His licensing bill could be somewhere in Iraq or someplace. But there's an amendment the department couldn't get on. It died in the governor's office. And there's an amendment that's very controversial to some people. And their vehicle died, and they're putting on by amendment in that committee with no notice to the public. And that's the issue. Never mind the amendments, good or bad. There's people in the hallway arguing about it. That's what I get to do when I leave here, whenever I'm called out. We've heard from the department about other ways when they change housing arrangements that people should have known stuff was coming. About matters in the governor's proposal, some stuff that the providers are not comfortable with, and there's not buy-in. Representative Rickman, I have no idea if you're just a vehicle here, but when stuff like this comes by that's been worked out by people, and there's no notice that this amendment is new, I'm just kind of tied in the department, Representative Rickman, not you, but I don't think it serves well. We're told by people at the table, not you, but other people who come in the department's hat, saying, well, this is fine, they should be okay with it. And they're absolutely, in the hallway, they're absolutely not okay with it. It makes me uncomfortable. So, this is MA money, and it's doing something or other, and so maybe there's a finance bill. But I hope that people can, the beauty of our process is that there's a bunch of people who come on certain days and those who don't because their bill's not up and it doesn't involve them. So.
We've been discussing this issue with different cells across the state with the Department of Human Services. There were two hearings in the Senate where it was amended and amended again. There were all the different provider groups that Representative Loeffler's concerned about that might not have been or that were there. And I don't think there's anybody, any provider group out there that has a problem with this amendment, but maybe Ms. Ruff can...
Ms. Ruff?
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I so much appreciate your comments, sir, because, and that's, in fact, why the Centers for Independent Living brought this bill forward, because we felt we had not been notified of provider standard changes. It was a complete surprise to us. So I absolutely appreciate your perspective, and I appreciate yours. And that is why we have amended it twice in the Senate and then done a delete all, because we're getting more and more feedback from all of the disability groups. That's, as an advocate and a disability representative, that's of utmost importance to us and the Centers for Independent Living as well. And so that, and your concerns, sir, were exactly why this bill came about, to fix that.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. McCauley.
I might also point out to the committee that this particular bill in Section 3 does include a notification requirement that hasn't been in place prior to this point, where the department will provide interested parties with information about changes to not only the our federally approved waivers, but the changes that are substantive in the disability program manual, with 30 days to comment. So we recognize that there have been problems, and we're working to address those.
Representative Ava.
Well, just to follow up, Representative Rookavini, you probably can appreciate at least the theme of my thoughts. And we would, and if this has been a if this is the product of a large work, but the audience is almost devoid of people who are interested in this topic in general. There's a few random people because they, I guess it's raining outside. It's dry in here, but so you know, it's thank you. I'll accept your assurance for now, but I just. But I'm still not happy with the governor's bill being brought forward, and you tell us that it's okay and it's not okay. And so, and that would be an issue to represent, you know, where people are being told to change and have higher costs for exactly the same service and live on lower prices, and it's supposed to be fine. So I'm maybe getting that still over still. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know what your issue is with the governor. I got a lot of issues with the governor. So, but, you know, this is because of governor's commissioner made a decision based on information he evidently got from assistant commissioners or other folks that cut out a group of providers that have been doing this for 20 years or better.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no notification like you're saying and like Representative Loeffler's saying. And we, as we dug deeper to get to the bottom of it, somebody was giving the commissioner incorrect information, blaming the federal government, and we had emails and everything tracking this, and we put it out there, and everybody said, yeah, I guess you're right, and the DHS came to the table, and we worked it and worked it again and worked it again, and this is, I think, the third product of reworking this amendment you see right now. And so I think everybody's happy, and you can get me the heck out of here.
I'll be happy to.
I think on the table is Representative Loeffler's oral amendment.
To the title.
Can you repeat that, or maybe have staff?
I think I'd have staff do it because I can't remember what I rattled off. But the one last thing I would ask for the representative from the department, are these standards, even though this is the first time they're written in law, are they pretty much the ones you have been using in licensing and reimbursement, the continuing ad and all this stuff?
Mr. McCarthy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, the standards that are here, the part of the problem has been we have not had specific standards for some of the service providers funded through these Medicaid programs in these programs. These options, what this lays out are three optional ways that the county, in contracting with the provider, can demonstrate that the provider does have basic provisions in place. Two of those are recognizing existing licensures that the provider has, the first and the third option. And then the second is the county certifying that the provider has in place the policies and procedures that are necessary. But for most provider organizations, this should not be any great change. And
Representative Anderson, is it to this point?
No.
Okay. Well, we'll deal with this amendment first, then I'll get to you. Mr. Chung, or?
So, Mr. Chair and members, Representative Loeffler's amendment would be on page 5, line 8, after the second semicolon, insert establishing provider standards for medical assistance waivers.
Okay. Representative Rukavina?
Finally.
Okay. Well, then let's proceed to vote on this oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. Amendment adopted. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the first page of the delete all amendment, it talks about the avail. It says here, insistence from one of the centers about the available community options that may enable the person to relocate to the community if the person is self and so on. What is it that could keep them from not? I mean, as far as it's a may, is there something there that could keep them from not going to the community?
Mr. McCarthy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, this provision is really focusing on assuring that people who may have an interest in relocating from an institutional setting have information. Once they have that information, they may or may not choose to act on it. So that may be a part of it. In addition to that, there are some barriers that a person may experience. For example, there not being accessible housing available to them that could not immediately be addressed, and that would require some time, and which is part of the reason we want to assure that they have an opportunity to work with organizations like the centers who can assist them further with that activity.
Mr. Chair.
Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned time. What timeline are you talking about? As far as time that it takes to approve them or what?
Mr. McCarthy.
Chair, Representative Anderson, in terms of approving a person who's interested in relocating from a nursing facility would set up a plan with the local agency. And there may be components of that plan that it will take time to get in place. For example, the accessible housing that I mentioned. And so that will vary from individual to individual.
Thank you.
Mr. McCarthy, you anticipate a fiscal note with this bill?
Mr. Chair, there is a small fiscal note for the administrative costs to track the certification and to make them available.
Are there any more discussion? The chair renews motion that this bill, House File 408, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Finance Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill adopted. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
I believe Representative Clark, you're next.
Welcome, Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So we are on House File
2100.
I will move House File 2100 that it be recommended passed and referred to the Commerce Committee at this point, Representative Clark. Yes. And do you want to put on the amendment right away?
Mr. Chairman, I think with the amendment, it might just need to be referred to the Health Committee, Public Health Committee. So if you could hold that referral where it's...
Well, we'll amend it after it's...
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
So, Mr. Chairman, the amendment is entitled A070400.
I will move the A070400 amendments to get the bill in the form the author would like it. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion is adopted. Representative Clark, to your bill.
Mr. Chairman, so members, what you have before you now is the bill, is the amendment titled 0400. So let me just tell you a little bit about that, what the amendment is and what the bill would do, Mr. Chairman. Basically, what we're trying to do in this bill is to look at the issue and ask the Commissioner of Health to create a committee that would be working under the direction of the Environmental Health Division to study the scientific literature and then come back to the legislature with recommendations about the health impact of bisphenol A and phthalates on children and in products that are intended for use by young children. And we say here that they're include but are not limited to toys, pacifiers, baby bottles, teethers, and so on. And we would like that report next year. We also want that committee to identify the least toxic alternatives. And it goes through in the bill and says who would be on that committee. And one of the groups that you'll notice that should be on that committee is the Minnesota Nurses Association. Mr. Chairman and members, I just want to tell you this issue first came to my mind. Many of you know I am a nurse. And at the American Nurses Association meeting here in Minneapolis a number of years ago. And so I think included in your packet is a document from the American Nurses Association that's entitled IV Bags Pose Patient Risk. Do you all have that? Did I get passed out? Yeah, okay, you got it. If you notice, as early as 1999, the Nurses Association, others including an organization called Healthcare Without Harm, were part of a coalition that were talking about some newly recognized risks being posed by the phthalate issues, the phthalate in the DEHP, it's called di-2-ethylhexylphthalate, one of a class of kind of compounds called phthalates that were that are in IV bags and help make the plastic more flexible. In addition, this bill references bisphenol A, which is also a widely used compound in hard polycarbonate plastic food containers, baby bottles, and some food linings. And what the nurses were saying then and urging us to look at is that this DEHP has been identified by the United States Environmental Protection Agency as a probable human carcinogen. That's by our own EPA. And there have been studies that have shown that it also damages the heart, liver, testes, and kidneys, and may have an impact on sperm production. There are printed materials that usually come with some flexible plastic healthcare products, and they caution about how these materials are used. There's certain medicines that seem to result in more leaching of these compounds into the out of the plastic, and then therefore into the material that are being that a person is receiving in their IV. And I'll just tell you that some of those have to do with cancer drugs, and we certainly don't want people who are dealing with cancer. For example, Taxol, used for breast cancer, Taxotere used to treat both ovarian and breast cancer. These are some that seem to be increase the leaching of this DHP from the plastic tubing into the solutions that are being administered. And the nurses, their article here from the Nurses Association indicates that. The good news is that there are alternatives. There are alternatives to the bags and tubing. And one of the groups that are very deeply impacted are our little, very tiny little babies who are in the intensive care neonatal units. And so, Mr. Chairman, what I've done with this bill is simply say at this point, we want to ask that the Department of Health put together the study committee and come back and talk to us about the latest scientific research.
Any questions, members? Representative Bob.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. So, Representative Clark, do I understand that Section 3 is still in the bill then? The manufacturer section, even though we're not to that stage yet?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Representative Bunn, actually, it references, the definition references those products that are up on line 1.7. 1.8.
Right, no, I'm talking about Section 3. And
right.
So the bill, so the duties of manufacturers, that's staying in the bill, even though you're only studying at this point.
No.
That's what I'm confused about, because your delete all says it deletes Section 2, but I don't believe it says delete Section 3. That's what I was confused about.
Oh, okay.
That is correct.
You're right. It should be delete, but I think that's an error, yes. It is definitely an error. It should delete all except that. Sorry.
Okay, so Representative Bunn moves that Section 3 be deleted. And what about Section 1? The findings in Section 1, Subdivision 1.
Mr. Chairman, I would like to leave those findings in. I'm not trying to delete that. I'm deleting the
okay, well, we'll start with
prohibition, and it's true that we don't need Section 3.
All right.
Sorry, that got...
And I think, Representative Clark, if Section 3 stays in, it still has to go to Commerce.
If which section?
If Section 3, the part you want to take out, if that were to stay in, just
yeah.
For your guidance.
Thank you. So. And that is, well, Mr. Chairman, that was an error, I think, in drafting it.
All right, so Representative Bunn moves that Section 3 be deleted. And I think Representative Clark is okay with that.
I'm fine then.
Okay.
That was over
here. All in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
Aye.
That motion prevails. Any further discussion, Member Representative Bunn?
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. Just on the language in the bill, although the new version is okay, but when you say explore least toxic alternatives, or even in the phrasing of the old Section 3, just to be a little careful, because the way it was phrased, least toxic alternative, even the least toxic alternative could still be less toxic, and could be could be even more toxic than the item you're talking about. So I'm just going to just comment that in the future phrasing, or even the phrasing of the study group, that you have to make sure that the a least toxic alternative could actually be more toxic than the item you're trying to get rid of. So, yeah.
And that was on section 3. So I think that's good. No, I think it's good guidance for going forward. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Representative Finstead. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, as a father of three, I want to confirm your findings portion of this bill. Can you explain to me this, line 1.12 through 1.14? Question would be twofold. One, is there scientific facts to back that finding statement up? And two, in your research on this bill, has there been science or studies to disprove that portion?
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, this is certainly a hot topic, and as I mentioned, nurses have taken leadership in this, and in fact, there are, the state of California has gone further. They've gone and actually done the whole banning that was in the original bill. And as we look at that, and I have looked at a number of different research articles, I can tell you that there is some discussion. Well, the Environmental Protection Agency has certainly spoken out and made their statements. The Center for, the National Institutes of Health and the Center for the Evaluation of Risk to Human Reproduction has also put out some information. And as recent as March 4th, 2007, Senator Barbara Boxer and Representative Henry Waxman have called for a disclosure of one of the companies who's actually been working with the Center for the Evaluation of Risk to Human Reproduction to talk about their role in some of the scientific research that's gone forward. Apparently there has been, you know, some questioning of some of the scientific research and who's sponsoring some of that scientific research. So I don't know if you want me to go into that or...
And Representative Finstead, you can be right, or, you know, this may be a time to... Were there some other witnesses that want to testify on the bill? If that would help get at some of the...
It will, Mr. Chair. I just want to make one statement to that, and then, you know, I'll see what sort of action we take that, you know, I'd like to take after the full testimony. But, you know, some of the words you said is that there's some discussion, there's some info being put out. You questioned who was funding the research. I will just say, putting these type of words, perception-based words, into the legislature causes a big concern for not only me as a parent, but also businesses around the state. You know, if we're going to legislate perception, that is a very, very dangerous road to go down, not only potentially scaring parents and families for what you may believe, you know, and I do believe you believe this, that this is exactly, you know, the way it's written is exactly the way you feel, but you also said there's people out there that would disagree with that. So I guess I would say, you know, first of all, I think this committee has seen a lot of findings on a lot of bills, and I would say maybe as a message to all of us is that I think we should stay away from findings because it's really, I just think it's a bad precedent to put these type of position statements or perception statements into bills and then put it into law. So I'll listen to the testimony, and I'm sure I'll have a motion at some point.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, if I could just respond, I hope I was clear that there is definitely scientific evidence, and I think there's discussion about it, and it's quite controversial, but our own U.S. EPA has classified these substances as probable human carcinogens, and the endocrine-disrupting properties of them have been what's been studied a lot recently. And maybe we'll hear some more.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Clark. Is President Liebman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, on a slightly different topic, Representative Bunn mentioned before this language about least toxic alternatives, and you do have in the amendment that we're dealing with that the committee shall also identify least toxic alternatives. And my concern is a little different than hers. I think I sat in on your committee today and heard testimony about atrazine, and mm-hmm. one of the points that was being made there is that toxicity may not really be the issue. When we're talking about hormone disruptors, it may not be toxic, and yet it may be extremely harmful. And so I just wonder if we couldn't find another term and take out, Representative Loeffler suggesting less harmful. for. I understand what you're getting at, and I think in some ways least toxic is kind of a term of art that gets used in these circumstances, but I don't think that's really what we mean here.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark?
Thank you for that comment. I have no problem with amending that to say least harmful alternatives. I agree with you. And that's where I think some of the discussion that we may hear where some of the issues of endocrine disruption, which has really come to the fore in the last couple of years, is
So, Representative Lehman, are you making a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would move that we, on line 1.9 of the amendment, that we strike the words least toxic, or strike the word toxic, and replace it with the word harmful.
That's fine.
And Representative Clark is okay with that amendment. Any further discussion? Okay, seeing no further discussion, all in favor of the Liebling amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Amendment is adopted. Ms. Goodman and Stanley, and Ms. Stanley, please, if you would like to come down to testify.
Mr. Chair and committee members, good evening, and thank you for the opportunity to be able to testify in front of you here. My name is Marion Stanley. I am the manager of the phthalate esters panel at the American Chemistry Council. The group has been in existence for 34 years now and represents all of the major manufacturers of phthalates in the United States. What I'd like to do today is simply tell you how very well studied in the United States phthalates are. Recently, the Consumer Product Safety Commission completed a study and looked at phthalates and vinyl toys, and they concluded that vinyl toys for children under 5 years old are safe. And this year, in February, at the International Toy Fair in New York, the lead scientist for that review reiterated that statement and said that there was no new literature to change CPSC's view. Additionally, the National Toxicology Program, Center for the Evaluation for Risks to Human Reproduction, has studied the major phthalates in commerce today and has concluded that there is minimal to negligible risk from these phthalates. On top of that, we've got the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention doing actual human biomonitoring studies, and the results are representative of the human population, and we know that exposures are actually much lower and as real measured numbers than estimates that have previously been made. On top of that, we know that the EPA has been looking at the reference doses associated with phthalates, and very briefly, a reference dose is the amount of any chemical that can be a human can be exposed to every day of their lives for their lifetime and have no risk. And the reference doses for phthalates show that the exposures that people have are well within those stated safety limits. In fact, in a recent review, EPA is raising one of their reference doses for a phthalate. So I think that gives you a very good idea of how well studied these are. I'm happy to answer any questions you may have. And I'd like to let you all know that I'm very pleased to be a resource for you. I can arrange meetings. I can arrange scientific reviews for you. I can also give you copies of every single one of these government published reviews of phthalates. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Representative Shumper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Straightforward question. Does DEHP leach from these plastic bags?
Yes. They leach in very minute quantities. And we're talking about plastic medical bags. Let me qualify that, because this is not used in, say, your Glad bag.
Representative Shumper?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the debate is really the extent of leaching or the amount of leaching.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is very well characterized, and the FDA has looked at that and has published a guidance document stating that the benefits of any treatment from DEHP plasticized medical devices outweighs the risks.
Any further questions for this witness, members? Ms. Goodman?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm going to talk to you about bisphenol A. My name is Dr. Julie Goodman. I'm a board-certified toxicologist. I
have a B.S. in Environmental Engineering from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and a Master of Science in Epidemiology and a Ph.D. in Toxicology from Johns Hopkins. And I was also a Cancer Prevention Fellow at the National Cancer Institute. And for the past 2 years, I have been on an expert panel tasked with reviewing the peer-reviewed studies of low doses of bisphenol A and reproductive and developmental endpoints. And we found that current uses of bisphenol A are safe, and this is not based on a few selected studies, but on the literature on low doses of bisphenol as a whole. And based on their own independent analyses, other government bodies have also come to this conclusion, and no government body has banned or restricted the use of bisphenol A. And just to tell you what it's used for, it's a building block for polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins, and actually products made with polycarbonate and epoxy resins often can actually protect the health of children. For example, polycarbonates used in sports safety equipment like helmets and visors, in plastic in eyeglasses, and in some life-saving medical equipment like incubators, kidney dialyzers, and heart-lung machines. And basically, this House Bill 2100 would lead to the loss of safe and reliable products and would leave consumers with less choice, higher costs, and needless fear. Now, there are trace levels of bisphenol in consumer products, but exposure to humans, including pregnant women and children, is extremely low, and also the metabolism and elimination of bisphenol happens in a day, so there's no risk of the buildup of bisphenol in the body over time. And probably most importantly, there is no evidence that any person's health has ever been harmed by any products made with bisphenol. And I just want to end by telling you that this opinion is shared by government bodies around the world. And actually in January, the European Food Safety Agency examined exposures from food, which is the highest exposures of bisphenol. And they looked at extreme exposure scenarios, including the use of baby bottles. And not only did they not find any health risks, but they actually increased by a factor of 5 what they considered to be a safe level of bisphenol. And 1 year ago, FDA stated, quote, based on all the evidence available at this time, FDA sees no reason to change its long-held position that current uses of food are safe. And I also am happy to supply you with any of the studies or data, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I want to point out that she's forgot more than I'll ever know. Thank you for your testimony and for your years of research and years of commitment to science. You mentioned a couple things that come to mind. You said that this bill would create a loss of safe and reliable products.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me, just expand on that quickly, and then I have one more question. And
well, basically, the idea that bisphenol is used for products that I said can increase safety and even save lives. And there's really, no one's offered up any alternatives. I mean, bisphenol has been tested, it's been safely used for 50 years. Alternatives certainly haven't been tested as much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you. In the findings, and I want you to confirm this or not, in the findings section of this bill, it says bisphenol A, an estrogen mimicking endocrine disruptor chemical.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a true statement?
Yes.
Dr. Goodman.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it is. And what that means, the way estrogen works is it binds something called a receptor. You can think of it as a key in a lock, and when the key goes in the lock, it opens the door. When the estrogen binds, it can then cause some effect. Well, bisphenol binds to this receptor at 1/10,000 to 1/100,000 as much as estradiol, which is sort of the natural hormone. So you would need 10,000 to 100,000 more of it to actually have any effect, first of all. And second of all, it should be noted that just because it binds it doesn't mean it's causing any harm. That's not a health effect. It's not a bad thing happening. It's just a biochemical effect.
Representative Finstead.
So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to show my true intelligence here. I can't probably repeat half of what you just said. I think I kind of understand it. So it's about the level of dose, for one, and then you also talked about metabolism and how the body doesn't keep this product. So what you're saying then, from what I've gathered, is that A, there's no need for this bill. Science doesn't prove it. And I guess that's what I'm hearing you say. Can you just confirm that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I can confirm.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have an amendment.
Okay.
I think that, you know, all week long we've been taking legislative findings out of bills. And I consulted with the author and let her know that, and she's concurred that that would be okay. So I'd like to move the deletion of Section 1.
All right. Any discussion to the Murphy Amendment, members? Representative Clark?
I'm fine with that. I think it certainly removes the kind of concern that was expressed earlier about alarm, although I would note that there's nothing that's not true in that statement. It hasn't been contested, but I'm fine with removing that, Mr. Chair.
Okay. No further discussion. I'll Representative Brown.
Sorry. I'm good.
Okay. All in favor of the Murphy Amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Resident Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to remember again where this goes with the Subdivision 3 that's been removed.
I think it's probably now going to go to the Finance Committee.
Finance, okay. And Representative Clark, are you aware of a bill that is being authored by Representative Madore regarding mercury and vaccines?
Yes, I am. I think you're a co-author, Mr. Chair, if I'm not mistaken.
Mr. Chair and Representative Clark, I'm wondering, I'm looking at this bill, and I know your commitment to kids, and I'm hoping to work with you maybe on this bill a little bit to expand it. I think obviously there's some issues with the bisphenol and things along those lines, but I can see a way that we could potentially work in the ethyl mercury and the vaccine issue as well. And I think if we're trying to help kids and also trying to create some better information about these different products, I think this one fits in very well. And I'm hoping to work with you going forward. I'm wondering if you would, Representative Clark, be willing to work with me on that, because I know that that's something that you've been working on in different ways in terms of the chemicals that are going into kids' bodies.
President Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I'm always interested in working with any authors on issues of toxics and children.
President Holly. Representative Clark, continue.
Where that should go, you know, I guess is something that could be discussed. But, I'm a co-author in the same bill, so I think, I have the shared commitment. I guess I just want to say that, I think we'll have to take this one at this point, and then I think we can talk about the other issues at another time in another bill.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up. Representative Clark, thank you. I don't plan to amend anything or try to amend anything on it tonight, but I do think when we're talking about kids and talking about what's going into their bodies, that issue is very relevant. And so I look forward to working with you. I want to see that issue move forward. And since this one is moving forward, I think it's very appropriate that we have a discussion about the other one as well as this one moves along. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Clark.
Thank you.
Representative Holly.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, while we're having that discussion, they probably ought to ask why two more infants died yesterday because they were not vaccinated for the flu.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. First, I didn't catch the last testifier with what organization you were with or who you are. You're just representing yourself.
I'm with Gradient Corporation, an environmental consulting firm, and I've been hired by the American Chemistry Company.
Okay. I thought that was the case, but I wasn't sure. I just want a clarification. There was no motive behind it. I just didn't hear the introduction of that. To Representative Clark, I found the other testimony quite compelling in some ways. Of course, it's from a particular group, so we have to weigh that. But I'm kind of a science-based person myself. And one thing that concerns me, I think it's always worth having our state, health department look at this issue further and to, evaluate for themselves the information out there independently. But the phrasing of what this group would do was, one, first, that they're going to study the scientific literature, and two, that they're going to identify least harmful alternatives. And the makeup of the committee is not necessarily a group of scientists, and I'm concerned about the ability of these individuals to evaluate the scientific literature. And did you want to share your thoughts on that?
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, well, we do say that one shall be a representative of environmental health sciences research, and then one shall be a representative of other health sciences, and there's still open spaces, but we didn't describe who all should be on it. So I certainly think there could be, another option for another particular scientist that you might be interested in. Mr. Chairman, I would just point out, in regard to the committee, to the testimony of the individual, I don't think anything that was said is contradicted by what this study requires. We're asking to find out what the truth is and to come back and help us make some smart decisions. And so this isn't causing any harm. This is hopefully helping us figure out how to reduce harm.
Representative Shumpert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to ask the last witness, when you were reviewing a lot of the literature to come to the conclusions that you did and discussing this at the link, did you and the committee that you were working with contact the American Noise Association and try to find out why they had taken this opposite stand? Did you have discussions with them? Obviously they weren't whimsical in making this assessment that these bags were problematic. Did you have discussions with them to try to discern the reasons for it, that they came to their conclusions?
Dr. Goodman?
Mr. Chair and Representative? No, we haven't contacted them, but, we've read all of their reviews, and it seems like, basically there was one small study conducted in 1998 that started this whole domino effect of people looking into this and thinking of it. And I think the thing I tried to stress and what we noted is you can't just look at a few select studies. You actually have to look at all the studies as a whole. And I think some people, probably not on purpose, but they tended to just focus on certain studies and not everything together as a whole.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, I hope that the committee that's created here will look at every single study and come back with the best advice to the legislature.
Okay. I would actually like to make one other amendment, Representative Clark, and that's to change the January 2nd to January 15th.
Mr. Chairman, that's a friendly amendment.
Okay. All in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Further discussion to the bill, members? And just to clarify, the bill is now just the amendments. Okay. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess without making this longer than it needs to be, we heard the testimony here from well-educated, well-decorated scientist. Would you call yourself a scientist?
Yeah.
Scientist that has given us her opinion and her advice after reading and reviewing many studies, many different papers, research studies, whatever it may be, about this topic. So I guess, why are we as a legislature going to tell the department to go find seven people to do what she just told us that she's done, that science already is doing? So that's my question. Without making this longer than it needs to be, I would urge members to vote no on this bill.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to comment that I have a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a JD, and I hope that Representative Finstead is going to give me the same deference in the future.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Chair Thiessen. I was going to say, I think some very important information was shared, but the two individuals testifying are representing the Chemical Society, and maybe everything they said was absolutely valid, and we will shortly find out when our health department takes a look at this that, yes, indeed, that's what all the studies indicate, but we can't rely on one particular industry group to give us the truth as a legislator. So, and I'll reiterate what Team Weasley said in terms of deference. Thanks.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that A070400. I'll amend my motion, actually. That the A07-0400 that House File 2100 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee. Presumably you're going to find the money for this in your committee.
Mr. Chair, we're going to sure try.
Oh, okay. Well, all in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Clark. I will move the House File 917 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Commerce. And Representative Clark, I think you have an amendment for this bill as well.
Amendment AO7-0402.
Representative Clark moves the AO7-0402 amendment. I move that. Everybody have that amendment? Okay, to get the bill in the form the author would like it, all in favor of that amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, this bill has been modified now to deal with the use of the pesticide lindane just in the case of young children who have head lice. And I think this makes the bill easier for committee members to deal with. There's still some research dealing with the uses of lindane for other purposes, and I guess I decided not to take that on tonight, Mr. Chairman. Let me just tell you a little bit about what I know about why this is an important bill and why our first priority here is to deal with the use of this pesticide for the treatment of young children. In August of this past last year, the USDA withdrew registration for the use of lindane in agriculture and called it one of the most toxic, persistent, bioaccumulative pesticides ever registered. And environmental health groups around the country have now been calling for the phase out of the remaining uses of lindane in pharmaceutical products in the U.S. All uses, including pharmaceutical uses, have been banned in 52 countries, including most recently Mexico. It's been banned for use in California since 2002, and there's similar legislation going forward in Michigan and New York, and they're banning it for any use in human health. I'm just looking at the incidence of small children where we're most concerned of what it can do. And what we know is that lindane can cause seizures and damage to the nervous system and can weaken the immune system. Case controlled research shows a significant association between brain tumors in children and the use of the lindane containing lice shampoos. It's also a suspected carcinogen and hormone disruptor. It breaks down and its products persist in the environment and they affect the people and wildlife around the world. The Food and Drug Administration continues to approve this insecticide and shampoos and lotions for both lice and scabies. And again, I'm not just dealing with the issue of scabies. But the thing is, there are safer alternatives, and my point in bringing this bill forward is to really require us to look at a safer alternative. One of the main alternatives is a specially designed scientist home for lice, and I know that there are also other alternatives that are used by families who have to deal with this issue of head lice that has to do with olive oil, something as mundane as olive oil in a plastic bag put on the head. Lindane is also a significant contaminant in our urban sewer systems. And in Los Angeles County, the sanitation district there, before they banned it, they estimated that one dose of lindane shampoo used as a treatment for head lice contaminates 6 million gallons of water. So the threat to clean water was part of the reason that California decided to ban it. And after they banned it, the Los Angeles County Reclamation Plans dropped the lindane dramatically. Mr. Chairman and members, this is a very modest bill at this point. There's more study and work to be done, but I just am very concerned that since we do know that this is a very dangerous chemical, our most vulnerable family members, our children, need to be protected from it. So,
thank you, Representative Clark. Representative Batwalt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Having five children of my own, I share your concern for these things. We're taking your word, I assume, unless we have a testifier, that all of these things are true of this. And you answered the question I had about safer alternatives. I'm just a little bit frustrated that we're spending our time on this and not on things that we really need to be spending time on, frankly. This, to me, seems to be something that the Food and Drug Administration should and ought to be administering. They're responsible for these chemicals nationwide. And I guess my question of you might be, why would we do this in Minnesota only? Somebody could obviously purchase this outside the state, for example, and bring it in and use it. Why aren't we focusing more on the federal level with this?
Representative Clark. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I've actually been around a long time and learned that the states are the laboratories for change sometimes in our country. And sometimes we get the FDA to come along and get enough states to raise the issue, and especially around toxic chemicals over the years. It's just the way it has been. When I first was elected, there was no right to know for a worker in our country whether or not they were being exposed to a toxic chemical. There just was not. There were, I think, 6 states before Minnesota at that point that had passed that law. And one of the things that happened is Minnesota went on record. We said workers should have a right to know. Firefighters should have a right to know. People should have a right to know if they're working with a toxic chemical and if it's in the community. And it took a couple more states. I think we had to get about 10 states to pass the state law before we got the federal government to then go on record and actually pass the federal law. So I would prefer a federal law. I have to agree with you. But in the meantime, we're going to
represent
for our people we represent. And I did indicate that the U.S. EPA withdrew registration for its use in agriculture already.
Madam Chair, Representative Park, I do wonder, just practically speaking, somebody buys this outside of the state. Obviously, sale being prohibited is pretty easy to police, but somebody buys this outside the state, brings it in and uses it. Your bill would ban the use of it. How do we police it? What are the penalties?
Representative Clark. Mr. Chairman, I guess what I'm hoping will happen here, I mean, it's not going to be sold in the state and dispensed from by our people, whether they're a store or physicians or others. I don't know if there's any penalties for use that, we're not going to be following people around if they're using it in that, or how they got it from that they picked it up in some other state. But I think hopefully we'll take a big step towards making the public more aware of what the problem is.
Representative Fetlock?
Madam Chair, Representative Clark, do we know, I'm a freshman, but what would, is there standard statutory language for what the penalty would be for using this? What would be the penalty?
Yeah.
Representative Clark, we need some help with that from our good counsel. And maybe this is something that we may have to look into and get back to you, Representative Fetlock.
Then the bill is going to go to Commerce as well, so we can maybe deal with some of those issues there. Unless Mr. No, okay. Representative Levin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry.
Oh.
Okay. Representative Levin.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Clark, I first of all, I have to tell you that when I think of the amount of lindane I used on my children when they were young, it really makes me cringe. And it doesn't work. There's a lot of resistance to it, and I'll tell you what you can use if Representative Gottwald is listening. Mayonnaise. Mayonnaise. That's what finally worked. But okay. I wonder about in your amendment, your use of the term or the phrase in young children. First of all, I don't know that young children is defined, and I don't know why you would just limit that to young children. I mean, what about just saying that it shall not be used or sold in the treatment of head lice in this state? I mean, with that, I realize that, that might be a little bit more provocative, but I think if we're going to just say in young children, we at least need a more firm definition than that.
Well, this committee can certainly amend this bill how they want. I was trying to take what I thought was the first step most for the most vulnerable population. But, if your advice is that it should be for all Minnesotans, I guess I would consider that. I would at least ask the committee that we start with young children.
Representative Ruth, to that point, Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have a copy of the FDA top paper on this, and it's the warning is in regards to people, and this is going to be even harder probably than young kids, but caution in patients who weigh less than 110 pounds. So, I mean, when they were writing this, I think that was intense with the small people. And I'd be happy to send this over to you, Representative. Oh, I'm sorry. This is the copy of the FDA paper. And the warning that came out was for people who weigh less than 110 pounds. And so, you know.
Right. There you go. Representative Tao.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Liebland sort of answered my question. I have two daughters, and I was kind of worried that if they ever get head lice, then this is banned. Now I could use mayonnaise, so that was going to be my question.
Further questions? Or Mr. Tennyson, would you like to testify? And please identify yourself for the record, please. And we do have one more bill that will probably be relatively short, but we want to make sure that we get through it. So if we could, yes.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm attorney with Great Bay Moody in Minneapolis. And I represent Morton Grove Pharmaceuticals, which is the sole manufacturer in the United States of limonene. I have a couple samples here of what it looks like. It's a prescription drug, only permitted in the United States pursuant to prescription. It's used as a lotion and as a shampoo. Now, I understand Representative Clark's modified her bill, but nonetheless, I want to point out that that's what's done in the United States. Now, if you want to buy it over the Internet, you go to Canada and you get the 17-ounce bottle over the Internet. So you can pass the bill, but you can get it over the Internet. What's happened over the last couple of years, and let me just start out by saying that lindane is not a pesticide as represented. It is an insecticide. Lindane is a pesticide used in agricultural purposes as a different formulation than what this is. Lindane is a secondary treatment. It means that when the first treatment hasn't worked, the medical profession is advised to look at something stronger or different that works. There is immunity to a lot of treatments, and these things deal with contagious diseases, contagious issues. Scabies, I had handed out these books you had in your packets the other day. You don't have them now. But I can't see it. Let's stop reading. He's reading the wrong page. Oh, I see. Okay. This is what scabies looks like. In hands, it is contagious, and it's a matter of mites crawling into your skin and burrowing in and laying eggs and doing everything else. Also, I want to point out that the issue has been studied for 50 years by the FDA, studied by the Center for Disease Control, and also the EPA. And there is an organization that sells mite combs that keeps raising issues about the safety of it. It is unsafe, as any chemical is, or any drug is, if it's misused. And the matter has been reviewed frequently. I have some comments I want to make, and these are prepared by one of our the scientists is a consultant with the company. As I said, it's not a pesticide in this circumstance. It's an insecticide because, by definition, it kills bugs. That's how it works medically. The active ingredient is a gamma HCH or lindane.
Mr. Tennyson, can you just move the microphone over a little bit? Thanks.
It's been used in agriculture in a vastly different form in terms of application, safety profile, and regulatory pathways. And it's not unusual for certain medications or chemicals to be invented for one purpose, such as a product called warfarin, which you might have purchased as 2,4-D, but as as decon or to kill rats and rodents. It's also reformulated and is used commonly for people who've suffered from strokes, heart disease, and so on. It's called Coumadin. So it's reformulated, used differently. So when you say that lindane is used in pesticides for seeds, it was used to treat seeds, and I'm not talking about that. But in 1951, the FDA approved lindane lotion and shampoo as prescription medications for three highly contagious infectious diseases that affect all people of all ages, not just kids. There's scabies, pubic lice, and also commonly sexually transmitted diseases. Collectively, these conditions affect tens of millions of people and have a price tag of billions of dollars. Consistently, the FDA has maintained its position that lindane medications have benefits that outweigh the risks. Every medication has risks. And it's a factor for all drugs, including, for example, Tylenol. On at least 14 separate occasions, and as recently as 2002, the subject experts working with the FDA have reviewed the available evidence on lindane and determined that lindane lotion and shampoo to be safe and effective for the diseases they are approved when used according to direction. Repeatedly, petitions to ban lindane medications have been rejected by the FDA and determined to be without merit. Ultimately, it is the FDA and not the legislature that has the appropriate expertise and jurisdictional authority to decide what pharmaceutical products are in the best interest of our public health. Indeed, effective treatments for these diseases are relatively limited, and none works on all patients. Moreover, the increased rate of resistance to approval of first-line medications noted in recent years also limits the range of treatment options available to physicians faced with controlling scabies epidemics and outbreaks of lice, which are not uncommon. And it's within this context that the FDA has maintained its position that lindane medications continue to be a medical need, to serve a medical need. Banning lindane medications would further compromise the rights of patients by denying them equal access to FDA-approved therapies. Now, in terms of safety history, the safety of lindane medications is well characterized and based on 50-plus years of medical use in tens of millions of patients, if not more. The most common side effects are non-serious reactions of skin, such as burning, itching, and dryness. It is one of the largest studies to date, involving more than 34,000 patients. Less than five tenths percent of the patients treated with lindane reported any adverse effect or any adverse event of any kind, and none were serious. Note that these results have been consistently replicated in other published lindane studies. In 2003, the FDA published results of a post-marketing analysis of safe data collected between 51 and 2002, concluding that lindane medications are safe when used as directed, and the serious side effects are rare. In fact, just three deaths attributed to lindane have been reported to the FDA during the 51-year time frame, and in each instance, the medications were grossly misused. In striking contrast to Tylenol, which has been reported to cause roughly 500 deaths a year, yet nobody suggests banning Tylenol, because the risk and benefit have been weighed by the FDA and others. In 2003, the lindane medications were repackaged to small, single-use bottles, and the prescription label has been updated for safety and medication guides well-developed for patients and caregivers, required by law to be dispensed with each prescription, all to minimize the risk for misuse and enhance product safety. In the last 12 years, just 14 safety reports have been filed directly with the manufacturer, Morton Grove Pharmaceuticals, my client. Of the three reports classified as serious, all resulted from gross product misuse. And unlike many conventional pharmaceutical products, there have been essentially no litigation brought against Morton Grove related to this product. I urge you to defeat the bill.
Mr. Tennyson, no, thank you. I was looking at something else, yes. Mr. Tennyson. Any questions for the witness members? Representative Bunk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tinson, given your testimony, could you comment on it in relation to, Representative Clark listed the number of states who have banned this, countries. We have long lists of countries. So obviously some decisions have been made by policymakers elsewhere that there is a problem. So is there a balance here?
Madam Chair.
Representative, Mr. Tinson.
I just, California is the only state that's taken some action that I know of that's actually passed the law. With regard to foreign countries, I don't know. All I tell you is in Canada, it's not even a prescription drug. You can buy it over the counter.
Representative Clark, to that point.
Mr. Chairman, as I said earlier, all uses of lindane, and I just want to make a comment about the different distinction between pesticide and insecticide. Pesticide is the generic category for that includes herbicides, insecticides, and other other descriptive, it's a larger descriptive word for these types of compounds. What I want to say is that my understanding is that 52 countries have banned all uses of lindane, both agricultural and pharmaceutical, mostly recently being Mexico. I didn't know about Canada. And as I mentioned, in California it was in 2002, and right now I know that Michigan and New York are both considering, and I think there may be several other states as well where this legislation is moving through there. Process. You can get an update on that in the next committee if need be.
Okay. And this FDA report, and I think this, Mr. Tennyson, this is what you're referring to, says that when used as directed, the benefits of lindane outweigh the risk. Is that what you were referring to?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Yeah, Representative Clark, do you want to?
Mr. Chairman, I guess that's if there are no alternatives, if people don't know that there are alternatives. And I think what's probably true, and we have several nurses on this committee who might also be able to talk. First of all, let me just mention this bill says nothing about scabies anymore. That's not in this discussion, so it's kind of irrelevant in terms of the discussion. But there certainly are alternatives, safe alternatives. And I think what we're talking about here is weighing the benefits to young children.
Okay.
I think the FDA was talking about something in a broader use of lindane for other medical conditions as well. And what we're talking about here is simply for head lice in small children. And I think Representative Rood pointed out the 110-pound
representation. Sorry, members, at this, I have to actually make a call right now, so I'd like to recess for about 5 minutes if we could.
Can I quickly respond to that for a second?
When we get back. Okay. So we're in recess till about 8:05.
Thank you.
nail polish. We get
I thought that went down last Thursday.
Yeah, nothing's ever dead.
I am. Yes, there you go. Thank you. The committee will come back to order. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to move to amend House Bill 917 with the A070401 amendment, which is a delete everything amendment, and establishes a basically has a creates a committee of stakeholders to review the scientific literature on lindane and make recommendations to the legislature on the health impact of lindane on children and report back by January 2nd. Actually, I'll change that to January 15th, 2008.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Chairman, that's a friendly amendment.
Okay. All in favor of the amendment, members, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. Further discussion to the bill, members?
Can I make one comment, Mr. Chairman?
Brief. Yes.
Lindane is, one, it's a prescription medication. Number two, it's a secondary treatment. It's not the first line. And President Frank Riker are the treatments. But this is what they use when the others don't work. This one, I don't work either, but that's the case. And And I would suggest to the stakeholders that you probably consult with the scientists who work at the FDA and review these things for and the people that have the capability to make judgments about the study. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Tennyson. I'll renew my motion, or I'll actually amend my motion that House File 917 be recommended pass and referred to the Finance Committee. All in favor of that, as amended. All in favor of that motion, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Members.
All right. Representative Khan is not here quite yet. She just walked away, so we'll. So some amendments are being passed out, members. So I think just for people's planning purposes, we're meeting tomorrow at our regular meeting time, and then tomorrow evening, and on Friday during the day. And we should have, I think all the bills for tomorrow have been posted, and I don't know about whether Friday is out there yet, but there's not. I think we're going to finish up in the nick of time. It's not our mind.
Oh, I can't call it.
Representative Khan, welcome to the committee. I will move House File 1618 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Representative Khan. And if there's some other witness that you'd like to come down, that's great.
Mr. Chairman, I'm pleased to bring this bill before your committee today. This is this bill would offer domestic partner benefits for state employees, and In 2001, the state employee unions negotiated with the state for their contracts to include health and similar benefits for same-sex domestic partners of state employees. And in 2002, the legislature failed to ratify the contract, but they then ratified them in 2003, only after the domestic partner benefits were eliminated from the package. And despite the language that we've heard, where the legislature should not modify union contracts, the legislature voted to ratify the contracts only after the partner benefits were eliminated. I do have, at this time, the domestic partners and, in some cases, the children of the state employees lost their health care benefits and sick and bereavement leave. The state employee domestic benefits partner benefits legislation would provide health care benefits to the domestic partners of state employees. And I would like to turn it over to, Scott Cooper, who would like to speak.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Cooper. I'm here representing Outfront, Minnesota. And I would like to give you just a couple quick arguments why we think this bill should become law, and give you a little bit more context for it to add to what Representative Kahn already presented. We have three reasons why we believe that you should pass this bill. It is fair, it is good business, and it is simple to do. The fairness comes from the fact that currently we have state employees who sit side by side in offices and in cubicles with other state employees that don't get similar treatment in their employment packages, similar opportunities to get equal employment packages and compensation. Obviously, many of us get our health insurance through our employers or through the employers of our spouses, and that is becoming a growing portion of our compensation packages. Some people are eligible to receive not only health coverage for themselves and for their children, but also for their spouses. Others are not able to receive health insurance through their employer for their domestic partners. We believe that this is not fair. We believe this is good business because it allows the state as an employer to be competitive in attracting and retaining the best employees. This is a very common practice in the private sector, and we don't think the private sector does this because it's just out of the goodness of their hearts. We think the private sector does this because they know that to be competitive as employers, they need to behave in this way. I have a handout I'd like to share with you, which lists, and I won't read it to you, and the hour's late, I'll just give a couple highlights and then you can look it over yourselves. It lists many of the private and public sector employers that currently offer domestic partner benefits. On the front page, there are all of the Fortune 1000 companies that have employees in Minnesota that offer same-sex domestic partner health care benefits. Many of them also offer opposite-sex domestic partner health care benefits. Some of the highlights here, 3M, Alliant Tech, AT&T, Ford Motor Company, Gap, General Mills, Home Depot, IBM, the Mayo Clinic, Marriott International, Lucent Technologies, Microsoft, Office Depot, Northwest Airlines. Second page lists many other Minnesota employers that offer domestic health care benefits. There are over 350 currently in the state employers.
And Mr. Cooper, just for my wife's sake, Ameriprise Financial actually is a Fortune 1000 company, so you may want to move that one up.
Sorry to insult her employer chair. The remaining pages list public sector employers that offer domestic partner health care benefits. There are a number of state governments, including our neighbor to the south, Iowa. There are many city and county and school board school district units that also offer domestic partner benefits. Some of them are listed here. I know that this is not up to the minute, and this is something that this list only grows. Like I said, we believe these employers do this because it is the fair thing to do and because it is good business. We think it would be good business for the state of Minnesota also. We believe that this is simple to implement, simple for you to do, simple for the state of Minnesota, because we've done it before. Not only do all these private sector employers do it, and other public sector employers across the country, but the state of Minnesota also did this briefly, as Representative Kahn mentioned earlier. The Department of Employee Relations is very capable at administering things, and they did create forms and processes for doing this during the short period of time these benefits were offered to your employees before they were taken away. We also have other experience in Minnesota. The city of Minneapolis, for a couple years in the early 90s, offered domestic partner benefits to its employees. Had no problem with the administration of it. The cost was not significant. Generally, across both private and public sector employers, the cost of your entire pool goes up about 1% when this happens. It was less than that for the state of Minnesota during the 1 year that you offered those benefits. I know the cost isn't something that's really in front of all of you, as that's a matter for the Finance Committee, but it was only about $200,000 for the year that it was offered for the state. One piece of context that Representative Kahn touched on is the history of how we got to this point. As she mentioned, the state did offer these benefits for a short period of time, and let me just tell you how that came about and why we are going about it in this way at this time. We believed for a long time that the way to do this was through the collective bargaining process. The unions representing our state employees have supported domestic partner benefits for a long time, have come to the bargaining table with requests for this. That includes AFSCME, MAPE, and IFO, and those benefits were granted by the Ventura administration after they'd been negotiated through the collective bargaining process. And as Representative Kahn mentioned, the legislature, in what I believe is a violation of the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, sort of edited the contracts and said, no, we're not going to ratify them in their current state. We actually are going to pluck out a benefit because we don't like it. And the message that was sent out at that time by the leadership of the House, Speaker, then Speaker Strigum, and Majority Leader Plenty, was that this was not a matter for collective bargaining. That this was not a matter for the governor to decide, that in fact Governor Ventura had overstepped his bounds, because this was a matter, it was a major policy decision and should come before the legislature. It was correct only for the legislature to decide this. And so we're taking that advice now and bringing it before all of you. We hope that you won't then send us back to the collective bargaining process and tell us that neither venue is appropriate for getting this remedy for your employees. And I guess I will leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Lippert and Mr. Rittman. Oh. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chairman Thiessen. Thank you, members, for allowing me to come here tonight. My name is Lori Lippert. I've worked for the state for almost 12 years. My partner Jane and I have been in a relationship for 25 years and counting. In 2002, when we had that short period of time that state employees were able to access domestic partner benefits, Jane was self-employed at the time, and I was able to put her on my health insurance policy. And that was a great day for us. We celebrated that, and then 6 months later, that was taken away from us. That was one of the most demoralizing days of my work life, not to mention a big inconvenience for us. I felt as though on that day I was being told that my work, the hard work that I do on behalf of the citizens of Minnesota, was less important than the work of my colleagues sitting next to me. Scott has talked about all of the kind of facts and figures and why this makes sense from a business perspective and all. So I'm not going to talk about that. I'm just going to say a few things from my own personal perspective. I was thinking before I came here tonight about the first time I ever did anything like this. It was about 20 years ago, and I went to a hearing in front of the Human Rights Commission, the St. Paul Human Rights Commission, and they were debating whether or not to include gay men and lesbians in protections under the St. Paul Human Rights Ordinance. And I sat on the side and I watched this whole parade of people who came and talked that in opposition of that. And the theme that ran through their comments was that gays and lesbians shouldn't be protected because the gay and lesbian lifestyle was inherently disease-ridden and promiscuous. So I think, here I sit 20 years later, I think, how ironic can this be?
We are debating domestic partner benefits, and the main argument that I've heard is that, horrors of horrors, this might be the first step towards gay marriage. And I think, well, what happened to my disease-ridden, promiscuous lifestyle, you know? Well, I'll tell you what happened. That was nasty, negative stereotypes that were used to put people like me down. And they proved in the long run to not be all that successful politically. So I sit here today and say this is not about irresponsibility, unhealthy lifestyle. This is about me wanting to keep my partner healthy and me wanting our life together to be as stable as possible. I've been thinking about my father a lot recently. He died 10 years ago in January. He was a great guy, really devoted to his family, a deeply religious man, and just devoted to his wife and 7 kids. And he was pretty traditional in his roles, attitudes towards roles. He felt like he was the head of the family. He was responsible for all of us, especially his daughters, until we got married, and then we would become the responsibility of our husbands. Well, in the year before he died, he knew he was dying of cancer, and it was very important for him to take care of all his business and all his responsibilities before he could let go of life on this earth. And during that year, he took my partner aside, and he said to her, he told her how important she was in our family, and he said to her, he asked her to take care of me. And he said that he knew that he could trust her to do that. And she told him that she loved him and she loved me, and of course she would take care of me. So I'm thinking of that because, for me, there's all this political talk about it and maneuvering, but what it comes down to me personally is that we just want to be able to take care of one another, the people that we love and the people that we've made a commitment to. And I wanted to come here tonight and ask you to help allow us to do that.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Mr. Rittman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman Thiessen, and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is John Rittman, and I'm a registered nurse, and I'm a former state employee. I worked for the Department of Health, and I worked in the compliance office. It was our responsibility to go around and inspect nursing homes, group homes for the mentally disabled and the mentally ill. We also surveyed home health agencies. Any sort of health care enterprise that accepted Medicare or Medicaid money. I was very impressed with the primarily the women that I worked with. The department did not hire new graduates. They wanted people who had years of practical experience. And many of the women I work with have been directors of nursing in various facilities, and many of them had graduate degrees and various specializations. If you work with people for a period of time, you get to know them. And since I was there for 12 years, I got to know the team members that I worked with. And I found out that most of the women who worked there were not there for the money. That was not the principal concern. They all wanted to be paid, of course. But we knew that our pay, actually, at least here in the metropolitan area, was slightly less than what they could make in the private sector. That may not be as true in some of the rural areas, but certainly here in the Twin Cities, that was the case. But you have to look at your total compensation package. And the general feeling was, between my coworkers, that the benefits that the state provided were very good, particularly with regard to health care. And, of course, off in the far distant future, someday, maybe if you are lucky enough, you might actually be able to retire and have a pension where you can keep body and soul together. So those were the motivations that kept a lot of people in the department. Also, many of the women had spouses that were either disabled or did seasonal work or things of that nature that did not provide benefits. During the Ventura administration, a contract was signed, and people like myself were allowed to put their domestic partners on state insurance. This was very important. I'm happy to say that my life has been blessed. I have shared my life now for the last 33 years with my partner, Tom. And this came at a very good time because Tom was his accountant, but he was between full-time jobs. He was working for a pool, and they would have work for him for a few weeks or a month at a time, and then there would be a stretch where he would not have work, and then more work would come. But there were no benefits. Tom and I had bought a home together, and we were concerned that we had this mortgage, and we wanted to be sure that if anything happened to either one of us, we wouldn't lose our home. So we were delighted to have this benefit. And I, like my fellow workers, would be able to cover Tom, and I did. Even though it meant that there were certain tax disadvantages to doing that that my coworkers did not have to bear. This whole thing being taxed on your benefits, which they did not have to deal with. But we were delighted to have the benefit. And then, a few months later, I received a letter from the personnel department. And it was very disappointing. It told me that as of the first of the new year, I could no longer carry Tom on my insurance, even though I was more than willing to pay the additional premium and the additional tax. So that was taken away. One of the underpinnings of our security was removed. I want to just end by just giving you a very short little anecdotal story. When this happened, I was quite angry, and I thought, well, what the hell? I'll get out of here. I can go work somewhere else. Nurses are in demand, and I'll even probably make a little more money. But then I got thinking, John, this is not wise. Hold on. If you wait around and button your lip, in a year or two, you will be able to take early retirement. And when you leave, you'll be able to take something with you. So that's exactly what I did. I shut up, I sat down, and I buried the shame and the sorrow. Well, when the time came, I did take early retirement. And let me just tell you a little something about the last day that I worked for the state. My co-workers brought food from home, and we had a little potluck party in our lunchroom at work. That was very nice. And we reminisced about the years that we had worked together. And my boss showed up, and she was charming, and she said some very kind things. And then at the end of her presentation, she reaches into her briefcase and pulls out this impressive piece of paper. And she hands it to me. And it was a certificate of appreciation for my years of faithful service to the state of Minnesota. It's really impressive. You should see it. It has the embossed seal of the state on it and the governor's signature. Well, this was my last day at work, and I wanted to be gracious and leave on a positive note. So I thanked her for the certificate, and I sat down, and I shut up. When I got home, I showed this thing to Tom. I said, look what they gave me here, the certificate of appreciation, how grateful we are for all the work I've done through the years. Tom looked at it and said, what a crock. It had been signed by the very man, the governor, who had taken away our health care, our insurance. I don't think it's always so important what you say, it's what you do. I'm asking you to send House File 1618 to the governor. I don't know if he'll sign it or not. He very well may not. But that doesn't really matter so much. I think what is important is that you send a message to all those other people who are sitting quietly and not saying a whole lot, who are working for the state and are doing a slow burn because they feel that they are being told that the people they love, the people that they share their life with, their significant other, the person that gives them a reason to get up every morning and go to work, that they don't matter, that they don't count, that they're not important, that they're not worth protecting. These are very negative messages, and I hope that you will see that it ends. And let me also tell you with regard to the the argument used by some people opposed to this bill, that this is a thin-edged wedge and that this will lead to gay marriage, which I don't think it will. We're talking here basically about fairness and equal pay for equal work. But even if it does, so what? I've been to Canada. They have gay marriage there. And guess what? It has not destroyed Canada. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rootman. Mr. Killen? And if Mr. Stanton and Mr. McAfee want to come down if they're here, or someone else, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kendall Killian. I represent MAPE, the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. We support domestic partnership benefits for state employees. For nearly 10 years, MAPE has been seeking domestic partnership benefits for state employees. The MAPE Government Relations Committee meets annually to review our legislative priorities. Last September, MAPE's annual convention passed a resolution of support for domestic partnership benefits. Simply put, domestic partnership benefits are a matter of membership equity. All of our member families, regardless of their domestic structure, deserve equal access to health insurance benefits. MAPE supports efforts to make state employment an attractive option for professional employees. In order to compete for the most qualified employees in the state, we must provide a robust benefits package that matches those provided by our counterparts in the private sector. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, please come down and identify yourself for the record, please.
Chair Thiessen and members of the committee, my name is Nancy Johnson Black, and I'm president of the Interfaculty Organization, or the IFO. I'm here for Mr. Stanton, who's attending his daughter's hockey celebration dinner. The IFO is the union for approximately 3,200 faculty at the seven state universities. I'm here tonight because we strongly support House File 1618. We thank Representative Kahn, who happens to be my representative, I'm proud to say, and others for introducing it. As you've heard, in 2002, our union fairly negotiated domestic partner benefits in our collective bargaining contract. At that time, we had 17 members of our union who were able to take advantage of this benefit. However, as you have heard many times, political climate changed, and we were forced by the governor and the legislature to remove the domestic partner benefit under threat of having our entire contract defeated. For us at the IFO, this is a simple matter. It is a matter of fairness. Our members in domestic partner relationships are just as talented, work just as hard, pay the same taxes and dues as our married members. They deserve equal or comparable benefits to members who are allowed to marry. People's compensation should be based on their work, not their lifestyles away from work. We urge you to support this bill, and I thank you for this opportunity to address you.
Thank you very much. Is someone from Mr. Cooper?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to pass along a message. Mr. McAfee called and has a conflict, is unable to be here, and just asked that we pass along the message that asked me to strongly support this legislation.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pritchard. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Pritchard, President of the Minnesota Family Council, and I'm here to speak in opposition to the bill. First of all, I do believe this is part of an incremental strategy to redefine marriage in Minnesota, and I think all you have to do is look at the definition of domestic partner. It directly contradicts our marriage, definition of marriage in our state. It grants marital benefits and marital-type status to same-sex couples for the purpose of state government employee benefits. It's really marriage by another name. We also believe that this bill is discriminatory, but it's discriminatory in the sense that it gives benefits only to homosexual couples and excludes other significant relationships, elderly parents of employees, adult siblings, extended family members, disabled adult children, or other close friends who are not gay or lesbian. So we feel that this legislation is in fact discriminatory against existing families. We also believe this bill is unfair to married couples. because it gives a significant benefit to individuals who have no legal duty of care for one another. They would be receiving the same benefits as married couples who have a legal duty of care, and yet these couples and individuals do not. So in a sense, these are special benefits. I also question the claim that this bill will make our government employment more competitive. It targets less than 0.2% of state employees. If we really wanted to make our employment for government employees more competitive, we'd offer a broader range of benefits rather than targeting exclusively same-sex couples. It also raises questions about violating our state's human rights discrimination laws, because it gives it regarding similarly situated cohabiting opposite-sex couples. So it very well may violate our state laws. And it also, we believe, will expose our state law to more legal threats. It makes our state marriage law more vulnerable to legal threats. In New Jersey, Vermont, and Massachusetts, the highest courts in those states, which struck down their marriage laws and replaced them with an alternative definition of marriage or civil unions, they reference the existence of domestic partner benefits in government activities. So we believe that this will open up the door to greater legal challenge. I believe that this bill points the need for a marriage amendment. A number of people have said we don't need a marriage amendment. Our state law is strong enough. And yet we see that this bill is a direct attack on that, albeit incremental. And so I guess I would encourage members to support this, defeating this legislation. Many have said to me that they support our current law. And I believe if one does, they will oppose this legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Pritchard. Mr. Erchie?
Yes.
Oh, there we go. All right. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm new to this type of a setting. Paul Erchie is my name. I'm an attorney in Minneapolis. I'm speaking in opposition to the bill. I'm looking at this as an attorney and as someone with the values that I hold. As an attorney, I look at the language here and I see that it's quite vague. See, domestic partner is has a rather vague definition. It doesn't include any kind of intimacy in a relationship. I don't think there's any real measurable standard as a lawyer to define who is responsible for each other's basic common welfare. So you have a phraseology language here that has no reference in the law that I'm aware of. People could come together and say, well, I'm going to assume a responsibility for someone else's basic common welfare. It could be a friend, could be a co-worker, someone in need of insurance, could be the step-parent, grandparent, needy child, except for the bill specifically excludes those people. So I'm concerned about the discriminatory effect of focusing on just one type of relationship here. I think the vagueness of it, the definition, and the lack of standards to measure would make it difficult to administer or enforce this by people in the industry. It's not restricted, as I said, to the intimate relationships. It's restricted to same-sex relationships of whatever type. And so I think there could be a discriminatory aspect of excluding heterosexual couples, boyfriend, girlfriend, other types of relationships. And I think Mr. Pritchard said, well, in terms of benefits without responsibilities, marriage has responsibilities. It's well-defined. It's historically understood. It's a social institution. And this other types of relationships don't have a statutory structure for any kind of commitment. Responsibility by definition. There are granted a few relationships of long term, but they're perhaps more the exception than the rule. But the other relationships, these relationships don't have a basis in the law. So I think you have to examine what is the state purpose for this. Is there a significant economic purpose for this law? I don't think that's been demonstrated. I think it really tends to foster a short term relationship and fosters, I think it invites fraud and uncertainty because people could claim to be in this some type of domestic partner relationship just to get some benefits. And I think it does chip away at the broader institution of marriage. Generally, it's a backwards trying to make these relationships on the same level and provide the same benefits as marriage. And at some point, if you add additional benefits or for same-sex relationships, then it becomes marriage becomes arbitrary. And so it does contradict state law. I think the emphasis for marriage in this country is for the benefit of children. This is the foundation of our country. It's the foundation of the family. The well-being of society, I think, is founded in families. And by this type of a bill, I think, undermines the notion of marriage as we understand it in this country. And I don't think that the benefits of it, if any, are significant. And the state is really, I don't think, any state policy that would justify this particular experiment.
Thank you. Resident Shumper, I think, has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Barchi, you indicated you're an attorney and you had some problems with the definition of the term basic common welfare. Could you give us a brief definition, a legal definition for partners or partnership?
Partnership? Well, there is I'm more in criminal law, but partnership, there's usually a contract that defines the relative duties and responsibilities in the contract of each partner. Each partner is legally assuming full liability for the other person's actions in accord with the partnership, I think.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions, members? Thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Come on down. I didn't see you back there. Good evening, Commissioner. If you could identify yourself officially for the case.
Thank you. I'm Pat Anderson, Dewar Commissioner. And I won't go over some things that have already been discussed, but I am going to talk about the collective bargaining process and also the fiscal note. As you know, my Dewar oversees CGIP, which is a state employee group insurance program. We also do all the bargaining and all the labor relations agreements. I think that it's well known that these benefits are collectively bargained by the executive branch. That's our role. The role of the legislature is to ratify or reject those bargained agreements, which has happened in the past. For the legislature to attempt to mandate and legislate in advance terms of collective bargaining agreements is something that I don't think has historically been done in the past. I also want to bring up, there is a fiscal note on this. I don't think you have it, though. It's been up since Monday. It's in the Senate. I have some copies, and I can leave them with the committee. The fiscal note is about $1.8 million, and it's a cost that is borne really directly by both employees, but also by all the departments, the agencies in the state of Minnesota. This is a cost, you could potentially say this is a cost to the state employee group insurance program, but those costs are paid for by a combination, again, of general fund dollars to the state agencies and also through the individual employees as they pay their fair share, their co-pays, and they're part of the insurance agreements. Should something like this pass, should something like this become law, it will, if it is not funded by the legislature, it will leave a gap that we will be dealing with in the collective bargaining process, which we've already begun. These dollars have to come from somewhere, and if terms are mandated by this legislature in advance of those bargaining agreements being essentially agreed upon, you're going to have to see changes in other benefits, maybe higher co-pays. And this is the same issue that you have with the issue of mandating that you cover all kids until 25, which is another bill that's been going through the legislature, whether or not they are students or not. That has about a $6 million fiscal note. So I want to point out those things. Questions?
Any questions, members? So when you're talking about the fiscal note, does that CGIP amount include both the state's and the employee's contribution? The number you're talking about?
Just the state. It's just the state.
And has that ever been done before that way? Have you ever counted CGIP contributions in calculating a fiscal note?
This is Nathan Morocco. He's the manager of the CGIP program at SOAR.
Hi. Mr. Chair,
welcome.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, have you ever done that before, included CGIP contributions in calculating a fiscal note?
Yeah, when Mr. Chair and committee members, whenever we do a fiscal note, it is always just from the state perspective. We do not include employee dollars on a fiscal note. It's only as it impacts state agencies.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, also, if I may, I'd like to point out that when we do these regularly, because there are many things in the legislature that affect the State Employee Group Insurance Program, historically the legislature has funded things that have impacted us through mandates through the program. So.
Okay. Any questions, Representative Brown?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I have a question in regards to the administration of this, should this legislation pass. Do you have it in front of you at all, the bill? I'm looking at lines 1.21. And what I'm concerned about is the language that says, if one domestic partner temporarily leaves the common residence with the intention to return, can you help me understand how on earth as a state we would determine whether somebody has the intention to return and how you would go about negotiating in that regard?
Maybe I can take that one. Just give me a second to read it again. Mr. Chair, sure. And members, I think this is intended to reflect the similar nature that that spouses currently have. If a spouse is residing outside of the current residence, you may be in that situation yourself right now. As representatives from Greater Minnesota, you may be residing right here in the cities, and your spouse might be somewhere else. And typically through plan design, programs don't like to penalize folks in that situation where it's meant to be on a more temporary nature. So you don't want to be subjected to out of network expenses and things like that. So I believe the intent is just to try and mirror that kind of benefit that exists with current married couples.
Thank you very much. Representative Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Anderson, perhaps you can answer this for me, because I think this is a concern people have. Some of the testimony we've heard tonight suggests that that partners, that if they're not allowed to do this, don't have access to affordable health care coverage. The truth would be, if you're both working for the state of Minnesota, you can purchase individual coverage, correct? Each mm-hmm. person individually can purchase affordable individual health care coverage through mm-hmm. the state, correct?
Mm-hmm. Matt, I think you have to answer actually yes or no.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Chair, yes. and I can expound on that if you both have regular jobs where you have health coverage, just like any couple that's married would, then you're not covered. So it would be... in the same situation.
Okay. Further questions? Representative Vincent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't catch your name, I apologize, but I'm going to call you the manager of CGIP.
How's okay. that? For the record, it's Nathan Morocco.
Morocco.
Yes.
Morocco, I'll remember that. All right. Mr. Morocco, as you look at how the definitions are proposed in this bill, from your perspective, would the state then be open, or quite a bit open, to fraud or potential fraud? And I can expound on that if you need more details. But I guess as I read this, there's no... if I'm in college and I work for the state and I have a roommate that is an adult of the same sex, I could then essentially sign that person up for benefits if I were to meet some of this criteria. And maybe not, but I'm just wondering, what's the means check on this? What's the potential for fraud?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure that I could answer that directly in terms of anything statistical in nature. But, you know, we really would be enrolling folks in the honor system just like we do today. If you decide to enroll for dependents, you know, we don't ask you to bring them into our department and show that they're actual dependents. We take that at face value. What we did historically is we required the domestic partner to actually sign a document that said that, you know, that step A, you know, A, B, C, D are all being met. And we would follow a similar process here. And then if we had reason to believe that someone was being fraudulent, then we would certainly investigate it, just as we do today with folks when we become aware that maybe a dependent isn't a valid dependent, or maybe someone is no longer married and they didn't indicate to us that there was a divorce. We do take appropriate action, and we do have language in our plan documents that do frame that as fraud and allow us to go back and recoup the claims. What some providers do, which we don't do today, is they do audits of of valid dependents, and certainly domestic partners would fall into that. But I couldn't give you any specific data on whether or not there's more fraudulent under domestic partner because it is less defined. I think it's a possibility, but I couldn't give you anything factual.
Thank you. Further questions for the witnesses? Resident Shepherd.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am concerned, Ms. Anderson, that your comments about the fiscal note imply something beyond an additional or extra or excessive cost that would be associated with domestic partners. If all of the people who are currently employed for the state, who we would call domestic partners right now, were replaced with heterosexual partners, they would be eligible to obtain the same benefits that prospective domestic partners would be eligible for should we pass this, correct? So we're really not talking about a cost to the state beyond what would incur if all these people were heterosexual couples, correct?
Sure.
Does that make any sense?
I'm not sure, but I can answer it in a couple ways. If saying that if all these people that would be domestic partners were in fact heterosexual partners, you would still have that additional cost. You would have the exact same additional cost to the system. Yes, that's correct. But there is a cost to the system, and that's the point. There is a fiscal note on this, and the legislature needs to recognize that. Just because this is a separate fund, arguably, because it's a program out here, there is a cost. I don't know how you would define significant, but there is a cost to the general fund that would need to be funded through the legislative cycle, and that's the point. So, but you're correct that it would be identical.
Okay, thanks.
Yes. Thank you, Commissioner. And this is going to the Finance Committee, so I think probably Representative Kahn's Finance Committee, so we can, if this passes, we can take that up there as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner, for coming down. Thank you, Mr. Morocco. Any other testifiers in the audience that would like to speak to the bill? If not, why don't we move to amendments? Representative Norton.
Chair Thiessen, I just had an oral amendment, and it was on page 1, line 10, to delete of the same sex. And this is based on some of the conversation that we had at a meeting a time or two ago when we were discussing visitation in hospitals. And I thought, while I'm not necessarily convinced that significant individuals was one of the terminology pieces we were asked to amend on last time, I'm not particularly comfortable with that, but I am comfortable with taking out of the same sex so that it broadens the
scope.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I would oppose this at this time. The problem is, and we'll obviously get to the fiscal impact at that, the problem is that will significantly broaden the scope of the bill, and that will significantly add to a fiscal note, which, you know, we have evidence, actually, as to what the fiscal note is, what the fiscal note, we have the evidence of what the fiscal note is from the 6 months of experience that we did have. We would have no evidence as to what the fiscal note for this would be. And the reason for this
specification, I would say that it's not discrimination, because the reason for this difference is the fact that these are people who are prohibited by state law. The people who want a domestic partner relationship are prohibited by state law from being married, and whereas people who are of the opposite, are heterosexual couples, are not prohibited by state law. So they could get married and they could have relationships at that time. And I actually know people whom that was the reason why they got married. They got married because they suddenly realized the various financial benefits that accrued to that. And so even though actually there's something which we could call the Texas model, which we might, and if someone wants to put in a bill to consider this in the future, I would gladly go on the bill with them. But the Texas model allows state employees, I think, and local employees too, well, let's just say state employees, to name any additional person as a partner, whether it be an elderly adult, whether it be a child who is living with them, or something, allows everyone to have at least one partner. And that's an approach we could take, and I would actually think that would be a much more complete way of doing it. But we haven't designed the bill to do that at this time, and I would not be comfortable with extending it in this direction at this time. So I guess I'd ask members to vote against the amendment. Much as I sympathize with it, and much as I would be pleased to next year carry the more complete bill also.
Representative Norton.
And Chair Thiessen and Representative Hahn. I appreciate that, but this is a policy committee, and so from a policy standpoint, I was supporting the language as something I was comfortable and could do, and that I assumed the financial issues would be dealt with in another committee.
President Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think Representative Kahn has just underscored a concern that I had, that this is narrowly focused on homosexual couples. And I would ask for a roll call vote on Representative Norton's amendment.
Representative Hunter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, you have two pages of companies listed on this handout that offer domestic partner benefits. Do any of those companies exclusively have those domestic partnership benefits for same-sex couples?
Representative Hunter or Mr. Cooper?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, there are some employers that have them only for same-sex couples, and many of them have them for opposite-sex couples as well. I believe that the number that do both is growing.
Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Norton, to your amendment, you commented that you want to take out the term of the same sex, but you're not willing to change domestic partner. Could you tell me why you're not comfortable in changing domestic partner to significant individual, as we've debated already in this committee?
And Representative Emmer, I think that there's an amendment that goes to that, so why don't we get to that issue next. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at this information about these companies, and maybe, Mr. Cooper, you can tell me if any of these companies use scarce tax dollars to fund these benefits.
Well,
Mr. Cooper.
Chair, Representative Broad, I'm sure that some of these corporations receive subsidies from the state or from the federal government.
Mr. Chair.
I'm just guessing, though.
Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll answer my own question since Mr. Cooper doesn't want to, but these companies don't fund their benefits on whether they receive any money from the state or the federal government. It's generally for purposes of expansion of jobs and things along those lines. But I'm certain without much information that they don't fund them with the scarce tax dollars. And I do recall we had a smoking ban debate in which we were trying to make sure that folks were provided some tax offsets for for the smoking ban impact to their businesses. And I recall, Representative Huntley, because I listened to you very carefully, I recall that you tried to match up or you matched up the spending on those tax breaks with our ability to fund nursing homes. And so I guess I would match this up in that manner as well. And so we have a lot of scarce tax dollars, and I guess I just wanted to put that on the table. And, Mr. Chair, just one more note. You know, I know that we're going to have a significant debate on this, and I think we've debated domestic partnership benefits already once this year. You know, we heard over and over again that we got criticized on the Republican side of the aisle for bringing forward wedge issues. What you call a wedge issue, I suppose, depends on which side of the issue you're on. But we get criticized for bringing forward these wedge issues. And, Mr. Chairman, you said it yourself, we have a lot to do over the next couple of days. And so it seems to me that we ought to be focusing on bread and butter issues that was intended by the majority or what they said they were going to focus on. We do have some snacks with us here tonight, Mr. Chair. We really, really want to focus on those bread and butter issues. Let's get to it. And, Mr. Chairman, I guess I just wanted to express my disappointment, and I understand why this is before us, but I just want to put that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Representative Shumper.
Representative Broad, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Broad, I just point out to you that if we pass Representative Norton's amendment, the fiscal impact, that is, the use of scarce tax dollars is going to be even greater, it seems to me.
Representative
Rod, to your point, if you turn the page, there's the second side, there's about 150 local and state government who use tax dollars. So.
President Gottwald. Okay. To the Norton Amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Thiessen.
Pass.
Abler. Anderson.
No.
Broad.
Yeah.
Bunn.
Yes.
Emmer.
Yes.
Finstead.
Yes.
Fritz. Gottwald.
Yes.
Hamilton. Huntley.
Yes.
Liebling.
Yes.
Loeffler.
Yes.
Murphy.
You don't have
yes. Norton.
Yeah.
Petremba. Rood.
Yes. Tau. It's
up
to you.
Yes. It does take some.
Chumper.
No.
Walker.
Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson, yes.
Can I change from no to yes?
You can.
Okay.
All right. And the chair votes no. Oh, did we not get you?
I got you.
Okay.
She passed. And Anderson changed?
Anderson changed.
One, two.
Yes.
To our members across the aisle, did you bring a knife to go with butter?
Mr. Chair, actually, in response to Representative Bunn's question, yes, we did, and actually I pulled it out as I was pulling the platters out, but in light of the discussion, I thought maybe I better put it where you can find it.
Okay. The amendment, there's 14 ayes and 2 nays. The amendment is adopted. Okay. Why don't we go to the... A1 amendment. Representative Emmer.
Mr. Chair, I had a couple of questions for Representative Kahn about her bill.
Oh, okay.
Representative Kahn, your bill, in reading it, and I think there was some testimony that it's rather vague, I would say that's kind. It's more than vague. In reading the language of this bill, it appears that it doesn't limit the number of domestic partners that someone could claim as being entitled to the benefits. Could you show me in here where there's a limitation that you would have to identify one adult as being the domestic partner that's entitled to benefits.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, I just read the sentence grammatically. When we say domestic partner with another adult, interdependent relationship with another adult, on lines 1.20, it says one or both domestic partners possess additional real property. So that's the person and the partner. You don't get beyond two.
Mr. Chair?
As an hour.
Representative Kahn, I have learned much from you in the last 2 years, and I know that you are probably one of the most talented wordsmiths around. And I'm not making that compliment I'm not trying to patronize you. I mean that. But I'm going to tell you, you are wrong on this one, because you are reading something into the language that is not there. This bill simply says this is a domestic partner, and one party can have as many domestic partners, and the domestic partner, that particular, if it's domestic partner one, would be judged with certain property, domestic partner two, and so on. And if I'm wrong, again, I don't accept the language that you've shown me.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, I will go to any length to make this bill acceptable to you. And so I would just suggest that the member and Mr. Here. Representative Emmer, you can make this motion, or you can substitute, if you need further clarity, we can substitute another to be one of us, if you would like to make that amendment. I would
Mr. Chair,
the members
Mr.
Chair.
And I do appreciate that, Representative Kahn. I will tell you, short of making sure that tax benefits will never go to pay for domestic partnership benefits and taking the term domestic partner out. Again, I respect you immensely, but we have a strong disagreement on this topic. I don't think you can fix this bill to meet... I'm trying to point out some problems that you've got with your language.
But
you can change it any way you want.
I'm not a member of the committee, so I can't change it at all.
Representative Emmer.
Next question. The other problem that I see is this bill, frankly, would allow a married person who is involved in a homosexual relationship to claim a domestic partner, and frankly, again, as many domestic partners as that married person would like to claim for purposes of getting benefits. And I see you frowning. I'm simply trying to be direct about the language. You have not restricted it by any means. And I don't know that it's fraud, because, frankly, if this would ever get into law, it would be legal. So I think you've got another problem, and if you can show me in the language where this would restrict you, again, we've I think already clarified that you do not restrict the number of domestic partners that can be claimed for purposes of obtaining benefits. So now, if there's some language in here, if you could show me some language that would restrict a married person who's involved in a homosexual relationship or who claims a domestic partner, since we've taken out, well, I guess we haven't. If you could show me where that limitation is, I would appreciate it.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, again, we have a very long history if you look at these four places, and that is an issue that has never come up in any of these companies that have done it.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Emmer?
Representative Kahn, that doesn't answer the question, so I take it that there is no language. I will just point out what you just held up. This is where our disagreement comes in. You're talking about those private companies that have made a decision, and I'm sorry, but I'm not talking about outside of Minnesota. I'm talking about Minnesota. The private companies make a decision as to how they want to offer benefits. That's their right. I'm talking about taxpayer dollars. This system, we have a disagreement. So, again, if that language is not there, I understand, but it's something you might want to look at. The third question that I have before you want to go to an amendment or if someone else has questions is, if you look at line 1.13, I don't know how you're going to monitor element number two in your elements that establish this interdependent relationship. But you've got share a common residence. Let's just say that's an apartment, and intend to do so indefinitely. Let's say there's a lease. By your own language, you have in fact made it less than definite that they intend to reside in that common residence indefinitely. So now it would become illegal.
President Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Morocco told you that there was a form and that all of these things were listed out on the form in some sense, and the people who signed that, who intended to commit fraud. Now, it doesn't say that it's share a common residence and intend to do so indefinitely. That means they intend to share a common residence indefinitely. It doesn't prohibit them from moving from an apartment to a house or anything like that. But there was, you know, I will point out to members that this is far more restrictive than the questions that are put before someone who is claiming a married couple where one person is claiming independent. This is much more information is asked for, and I think Mr. Morocco made it clear that the person signs a form, and if they are misrepresenting anything in that form, then they're guilty of fraud.
President Gottwald.
That was my question. Thank you.
And then the A1 amendment.
I'd move the A1 amendment. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this removes this term domestic partners. I would have to make an oral amendment to the amendment, Mr. Chair, because I see that Representative Norton has picked up on line 1.4, and that's what we've already passed, and I do thank her for that.
So the amendment
would remove line 1.4. The rest of the references have to do with the term domestic partner being replaced by significant individual. Now, this committee has had this debate at length, and I think everyone understands what it is. So I will ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Any discussion, members? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Keeson.
Nope.
Abler. Anderson.
Yes.
Fraud.
Yes.
Bunn.
No.
Emmer.
Yes.
Finstead.
Yes.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Hamilton. Huntley.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Rude.
No.
Tao.
No.
Chumper.
No.
Walker.
No.
There's 5 ayes and 11 nays. The motion does not prevail. To the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll offer the A2 amendment.
President Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going a little bit on the lines of what Representative Broad was saying, that it was my understanding that through the new Speaker of the House and the new majority that we were staying away from wedge issues and social issues, and we were going to focus on these bread and butter issues. Well, we saw that hasn't worked out so well. So now we have a bill in front of us that's talking about domestic partner benefits. So I thought that, you know what, let's throw this issue to the state and let the state, the citizens of the state, decide. It's a very simple, easy-to-understand amendment that essentially would put an amendment on the November 2008 general election that would give every citizen of the state an opportunity to vote on the definition of marriage. And I would ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chair.
Roll call is being requested. So this is a constitutional amendment.
On a bill.
That would go on the, that would be submitted to the voters. Any discussion to the amendment?
Chairman, I would oppose the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Member.
I'd absolutely support it, and I would echo exactly what Representative Finstead has said. That's why we brought the props tonight. Hopefully that'll settle folks just a little bit. I will point out that Laura Broad brought monastery cheese. I don't know what the significance of that is. But this is an important issue, and if this is the route that we're going to go, if we're opening up the door and we're going to talk about this stuff, then it's entirely appropriate, and I hope the folks on the other side, if they are going to support this proposal for domestic partnership and domestic partnership benefits, that they will also see it in their heart to give the citizens of the state of Minnesota the right to vote on the issue of marriage.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to remind Representative Pinstead that Representative Kahn has a PhD.
Not impressed.
Any further discussion to the amendment, members? Seeing none, the clerk will take the roll.
Thiessen.
Nope.
Anderson.
Yes.
Broad.
Yes.
Bunn.
No.
Emmer?
Yes.
Finstead?
Yes.
Gottwald?
Yes, absolutely.
Huntley?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'll accept that.
Huntley?
No.
Liebling?
No.
Loeffler?
No.
Murphy?
No.
Norton? Rood.
Nope.
Powell.
No, but the bread is good.
Chumper.
No.
You should try it.
Walker.
No.
5 ayes, 11 nays. The motion does not prevail. Representative Gottwald, day 4 amendment. Is that you?
Yes.
To your amendment. Representative Gottwald moves day 4 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This adds language, obviously, indicating that a domestic partner is not eligible to receive benefits if the person proposed to receive those benefits is younger than 18 years of age. A domestic partner in this case ought to be a legal adult responsible for their own actions and consequences. So it's a fairly straightforward amendment. I'd ask for the members' support. And a roll call vote, please.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Kahn.
I'll accept that amendment. One of the points on the form was that the person had to be, say that they were an adult. And I don't want to go into 18 is, so it's not, people want this on the bill, they can put it on. I don't think it's necessary, and it's silly, but if you want it on, just put it on.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Just a drafting suggestion. A simpler way would be just to line 1.9, substitute an adult for a person. The other reference is to an adult already.
Up to you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I had thought of that, but since the author is willing to accept the amendment, I think we'll just put it in the way it is.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I think if you're willing to accept Representative Loeffler's change, it's a little needed.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
You're willing to accept. So you're going to. Maybe if you just withdraw the A4 amendment and offer amendment that would, on 1.9, person is replaced by adult.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I'll withdraw the A4 amendment and on line 1.9, instead of, it will now read domestic partner means an adult who has entered into a committed and dependent relationship.
Thank you. So the amendment, yes, it's actually an adult.
Mr. Chair, where is it defined somewhere in the law that an adult is 18 years old, or is it 21, or is it 14?
517.02.
And what statute is that, Mr. Chairman?
The one.
Someone asked 517.
Oh, sorry.
And while you're looking, Mr. Chair, I am concerned because there are bills floating around that adults would still be children up to the age of 25, dependent children, and
marrying children.
Yeah.
Yes, 517.02 talks about persons capable of contracting, and it's at the full age of 18 years.
So
if you want to, if you want to say an adult of older than 18 years, I mean, we can do that.
Mr. Chair, I'd accept that addition.
An adult 18 or older, is that?
Yes. Thank you.
So the amendment is an adult 18 years or older.
Does everybody on that amendment, does everybody understand it? To the Gottwald Amendment, all in favor of that say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The amendment.
Did you call for roll on that?
He did.
No, he offered the first amendment.
He withdrew it? That's right.
On the A5 amendment.
That's mine, Mr. Chair. I move the A5 amendment.
Representative Emmer moves the A5 amendment. Your amendment, Representative Emmer.
Rather straightforward. It just says that a domestic partner, if this would ever become law, would not be eligible to receive benefits if convicted of criminal sexual conduct. And I'd ask for a roll call.
Any discussion, Representative Connor? Have you seen the amendment?
Yes, I would oppose this amendment. I think it's insulting and offensive, and we don't put the same characters, we don't put the same restrictions in for any other benefits in the state.
For the discussion to the amendment?
Like children or...
The roll call has been requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Houston.
No.
Anderson.
Yes.
Rod.
Yes.
Bunn.
No.
Emmer.
Yes.
Finstead.
Yes.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Huntley.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Betrempel. Rood.
No.
Tau.
No.
Chumper.
No.
Walker.
No.
5 ayes, 11 nays. The motion does not prevail. To the A6 amendment. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As testimony was mentioned tonight, that several people mentioned that these are committed partners, and I believe that if that's truly the case, then this shouldn't be a problem having this language in the law to deny if they were a domestic partner of someone else within the past 90 days, then they would not be eligible for benefits. But if they truly were committed to one another, then it would be a long-standing relationship. I ask for a roll call.
Roll call, Representative Connor.
Mr. Chairman, again, this is frankly, we don't put the same requirements on marriage. And I recall that we've had members of the legislature who have gotten married in the courts, and the thought of saying that they shouldn't have benefits if they haven't been married for 90 days and it's not a committed relationship is still.
Representative Anderson, do you have any further? Okay. Further discussion to the amendment? You did ask for a roll call. Yes, we got that. Clerk will take the roll.
Thiessen.
No.
Anderson.
Yes.
Broad.
Yes.
Bunn.
Yes.
Emmer.
Yes.
Finston.
Yes.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Huntley.
No.
Liebling.
Yeah.
Loeffler.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Rood.
No.
Tau.
No.
Chumper.
No.
Walker.
No.
Liebling.
No.
6 ayes and 10 nays. The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just an editorial comment on that for members of the other caucus.
Of the committee.
Of the other one. You should look into the insurance relationship that my very good friend from your caucus, Representative Mike Oscott, had at the time he was in the legislature. I don't think you'd want to.
Thank you, Representative
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Several businesses that I've had to go and work for and had the pleasure of interviewing and then getting hired to the company, I had to prove myself, and of course it was only 60 days, but I did not get benefits until I had been there for 60 days. And so, you know, it's maybe some have
proved to be 90. But I know that in my two former committee, two companies that I've worked for, I did not get benefits for the first 60 days of working for them to prove my loyalty to the companies.
Well, and we, I mean, we voted on the amendment. The way I read the amendment is that it was saying if you've been the domestic partner of another person within the last 90 days, you couldn't be a domestic partner now. I have a feeling there was, that's, I don't think the amendment was saying what you were saying, Representative Anderson, but we passed on it, voted on it. So the A7 amendment.
I'll move the A7 amendment, Mr. Chair, and I'll ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Go ahead, Representative Hubbard.
Oh, you want me to explain what it is? I thought in this committee when we had repealers, we just kind of slipped them in.
We've always talked about the repealers.
That's true. You're right. You're right. That was a low ball. This amendment would repeal the definition of marriage. I think that's enough said.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I have certain sympathy with doing that. I did vote against it when it was enacted at the first time. And I'll tell you, Representative Emmer, if you put in a bill to do that next time, I'll go on it to co-author gladly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
I do appreciate that, Representative Kahn. I'm offering the amendment, and I will be voting no.
As will I, members, and I... Sorry, Representative Kahn. Clerk will take the roll.
I actually asked people to vote no.
Okay, thank you. The clerk will take the roll.
Thiessen.
No.
Anderson.
No.
Broad.
No.
Fund.
No.
Emmer.
No.
Finstead.
No.
Gottwald.
No way. And that can count for two if you want it.
Huntley.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton. No.
That's a no.
Oh.
Long night.
Rood.
No.
Tao.
No, Steve.
Chumper.
No.
Walker.
Yes.
One eye, 15 nays. I thought we were going to get unanimous once tonight, but the motion does not prevail. The DE1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the DE1 amendment.
Representative Brown moves the DE1 amendment. Two-year amendment, Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, we have a lot of work to do, and I know that both you and Representative Huntley have been doing yeoman's work and moving us forward as well as the rest of the committee. But I do think that we ought to be focusing on health care reform and issues related to cost, quality, and access. And so, Mr. Chairman, I would put out here tonight, because I think this is where we ought to be focusing, the governor's health care proposal.
Okay. Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair, I really like this amendment, and that's why I'm the chief author of this bill. But it does need a little improvement. So, Mr. Chair, I would move that on line 1.2, you delete the current language and insert after line 2.7, add. And then on line 1.3, strike the 1 and insert a 2.
Okay, to Representative... Did everybody...
Mr. Chairman, I withdraw my amendment.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, members. We don't have any further amendments, members, so to the bill.
Oh, I do.
Oh, Representative Broad. No, Representative Gottwell also wanted to speak, so why don't we do that first? Why don't you go ahead?
Mr. Chair, to the bill.
No,
just a final comment. I think we've heard testimony tonight so far that this bill is narrowly focused on homosexual couples. We just heard the author of the bill, Representative Kahn, say that she would be glad to support an action that would destroy the definition of marriage as it's currently defined in state law. And you take these two things combined, and I'm also looking back to the testimony of one of our testifiers, I don't recall the name, but the statement was based on their work, not their lifestyles. And we have a bill here that is narrowly focused on a lifestyle. And I would argue that this is inappropriate. Aside from the joking about bread and butter issues and wedge issues, this is clearly a wedge issue. These are people who have access to health insurance. So if we're doing this to give them access, that's not the case. Individuals have access to health coverage if they're working for the state of Minnesota. We heard testimony from the department on that. And I would ask you to vote it down. Representative Conn.
Chairman, first of all, the bill is no longer narrowly focused. Thanks to the vote of the committee, the focus of the bill has been expanded. And second of all, we have heard that people, a domestic partner of someone who is working for the state, does not have access to health insurance unless they are also working for the state. So, or for someone that does. So, we don't have that restriction for married partners, and we're trying not to have it for them.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chairman, I hope that the committee and those of us who've been in this room and other rooms for a long period of time understand, you know, the lightness of some of the things that we do. But we do understand very clearly that this is an important issue, and it's an important issue for both the opponents and the proponents, and so not to minimize that. But I would actually, Mr. Chairman, like to move an oral amendment on line 1.20, I'd like to add the words, after the word possess, I'd like to add the words, but does not homestead additional real property. And Mr. Chairman, my rationale for doing this is if we're going to have them having real property, but yet at the same time are requiring that they share a common residence, they ought not to be homesteading two separate properties.
Okay, my understanding was they share a common residence, but Representative Conn?
No. Huh. I would just say no. I don't understand. I understand in order to qualify for homestead, you have to be living in it. You've already said that they're living in it. So I don't understand the application.
That was my understanding, too, as well. But Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this actually, I think, just firms that up, is sharing a common residence and living in a common residence are two very different things. And this just essentially says that if you are living there, you shouldn't be homesteading a different property. And this just makes a clarification in that regard, in regards to the taxation of each of those separate properties. And so, Mr. Chairman, this really is just a clarification intended to ensure that the common residence and the domestication of that common residence is occurring. So I would request a roll call.
Representative Conn.
Mr. Chairman, I also understand that one person cannot. We do allow homestead of cabin properties, too. That's something that we added in recent years. So one person can homestead two properties.
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe you can homestead two properties. You have to prove that you live in those properties. That's the purpose of the homestead, because you essentially get a class, a tax benefit for that homestead versus being a non-homesteaded property. So if somebody's homesteading a cabin, then their other property that they own is a non-homestead property.
I didn't know if you had any further comments to make.
Okay. I don't have
any. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Broad, do you know, can a married couple homestead two different properties?
No. Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, you have to homestead the property that you reside in, so my belief is no.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Conn.
Actually, the only requirement, there is no requirement for a married couple to be living in the same. There are actually some very eminent couples in my district. In fact, I believe I know who are married and who do not live in the same places, and I'm sure they're both homesteading them. So this has more restrictions on the behavior of couples than we do have for married couples in the state. So there's no restriction on that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what you're saying is that they're living in two different properties.
Yes.
This bill says that they have to live in the same property. Therefore, neither one should have two homesteads. is all it's saying. So we're all on the same page. It just, if they're required to be sharing a common residence, there should be one homestead between the two.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, I don't think we should be mixing personnel policy with state property tax policy. This is not a committee that knows necessarily all the ins and outs of how I think that you homestead for a year, not for that day, that particular day. So you may have been living in the property as of January 2nd. You found the love of your life and you moved in with them on March 1st, but it's homesteaded for that whole year. I don't think this committee should be dealing with tax policy.
Representative Gottwald.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'll start off by responding to Representative Loeffler. The point is, we are defining in this law, it is attempting to define that these two are living together in the same residence. And so, we are simply taking state law and saying that's a homesteaded property.
Okay.
My further comment is, by Representative Kahn's very statements here tonight, she's been equating everything to what married couples have. That isn't what we do for married couples. You're absolutely right, Representative Kahn. We are treating married couples differently. And that's what's in state law right now. And if the attempt of your bill is really to equate domestic partnership with marriage, then why don't you say that's what the intent of the bill is?
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, that's not the attempt. The attempt of the bill is to give health benefits health insurance benefits to domestic partners. We have put in, to tighten the definition, we have put in some restrictions that we don't have on married couples. So we haven't done it. But in general, the idea is to say that the two people, as you heard from some of the people who testified before us, two people working side by side even will have essentially the same benefits. They don't have it. There are different tax implications, different tax benefits, and they're more restrictive in what they do. For example, they can't live in two separate properties, which married couples could be. We're only looking at one person. They can't have ex-spouses on benefits and a new spouse on benefits at the same time. So so it isn't exactly the same, but we're trying to do one simple thing, and that's give domestic partner benefits to non-married adults.
No, Mr. Chair, I would briefly just point out, one is an argument for extending benefits to a group of people. The other is constant comments arguing that because one group has one set of benefits, the other group should. And it's a matter of equating versus extending benefits. And I've heard you say both things, and I don't think they're, you know, they're not mutually exclusive.
Simply, the extension of benefits is an example of increasing of basic fairness in state employment. And that's all it's intended to do.
All right, I think we're fully informed, members. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to respond to Representative Loeffler's comments because she is directly contradicting what she says, because you point out that we're not here to talk about personnel policy dealing with tax, and that's exactly what we're doing. The commissioner testified that this is something that is done and negotiated through the administration. Right now, we are adding a benefit to that negotiated process, and because of that, we should then, let's debate what we're going to do then. What are the checks? What are the check boxes?
And Representative Finstead, I think she said you don't want to mix in the tax property tax policy with the personnel benefits.
I understood what she said, and I still stand with what I have just said, so you don't have to continually correct my thoughts and positions when I talk. I think I can think for myself. My certificate, Mr. Chair, looks just like yours.
Thank you, Representative Finstead. We're fully informed. There's a roll call then requested. Quickly take the roll.
Thiessen.
No.
Anderson.
Yes.
Broad.
Yes.
Bunn.
No.
Emmer.
Yes.
Finstead.
Yes.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Huntley.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Otremba. Rude. Tao.
No.
Chumper.
No.
Walker.
No.
5 ayes, 11 nays. The motion does not prevail.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move an oral amendment.
Representative Member.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Kahn, because this last amendment seemed to be so difficult, I guess it alerted me to the fact that the language that Representative Kahn has proposed from 1.12 through through the end of the page, 1.23, is rather insignificant and needless. So I am going to move twofold. One, every reference to domestic partner is replaced with the term significant individual. Two, on line 1.9, I would like it to be changed to read that significant individual means a person, and then after the word who, insert the following language: resides with the employee on a full-time basis, then strike everything through the end of the page. And then as soon as you're there, Mr. Chairman, I go to the next page. And on line 2.6, after the word two, I would insert the following: one significant individual designated by the state employee, and then leave line 2.7.
All right, so the amendment, members, is to change domestic partner to significant individual, and on line 1.9, strike the language and insert significant individual means a person who resides with the employee on a full-time basis. Strike lines 1.10 through 1.23, and on 2.6, strike everything after 2 and insert one significant individual designated by the state employee. Is that right?
Yeah, it is, Mr. Chair, and I'd ask for a roll call.
Okay, roll call has been requested. Discussion, members.
Yes, I'd like to explain it, Mr. Chair. There are two things that occurred to me as Representative Kahn was answering the questions and we were having the debate. The first is, there really is no reason to have the elements that are set forth that frankly are unworkable, I think, as we established earlier. There's no reason to have those elements if you're not going to actually have any teeth in them. The amendment proposed by Representative Broad to require only one homestead exemption is frankly a simple and no-brainer amendment if, in fact, you intend what is written about living in the same household, residing indefinitely in the same household. If we don't need the exemption, then we certainly don't need the requirements. So I've eliminated that. And then second, and probably more importantly, since it gets right to the heart of the debate, the issue has to do with, clearly, the debate here is between traditional marriage and homosexual relationships. Representative Kahn has made it clear in response to her, or in responding to Representative Gottwald, that she is in no way attempting to equate this proposal to traditional marriage. In fact, all she wants to do is expand benefits. If that is true, if that is truly the intent, and I don't doubt it since she said it, then there's no need to create the term domestic partner in our law. Because that, in fact, is what causes the problem. It's when Mr. Pritchard testifies to the discrimination, it is real. If you are going to discriminate and say that only same-sex couples, you can remove the language, but the way the rest of it is written clearly indicates that same-sex couples would be the only ones that would be allowed to have access to these benefits, then you are, in fact, redefining the law. And I think it's important that we recognize that and have the discussion. So that's the purpose of the amendment, and I hope you will all support it since it's consistent with Representative Kahn's intent.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I would oppose it. This would dramatically, again, expand the scope and dramatically expand the cost.
Further discussion, members?
Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Thiessen.
No.
Anderson.
Yes. Anderson. I knocked over something. I'm sorry.
Rudd.
Yes.
Bunn.
No.
Emmer.
Yes.
Finstead.
Yes.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Huntley.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Rood.
No.
Powell.
No.
Chumper.
No.
Walker.
No.
5 ayes, 11 nays. The motion does not prevail. Representative Brock.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question. I guess I'm still confused, Representative Kahn. If our goal is to expand this to more than just same-sex couples, why do we need the term domestic partner in our law? I guess I'm a little confused. I guess I'm a little worried that if we have the mother or the child, maybe a 50-year-old child, but the child who's working at the state who puts the mother, the elderly mother, as their individual, as their partner on their insurance, which I think is what I understand the change to allow. Why do we need the term domestic partner? Why, you know, they might not want to consider themselves in a certain way or not. I think that I'm trying to figure out what the rationale for the terminology is if we're really trying to cover more than just same-sex couples.
Representative Kahn.
The rationality is to limit it. We've now expanded it slightly to same-sex, heterosexual couples, but it's still couples. Mother and child is specifically prohibited, if you note, lines 1.14 and 1.15, so those are specifically prohibited by that.
President Brock.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, then maybe I'm going back to a discussion that we had on a different bill related to domestic partners, that we actually did expand it in a way that allowed for that parent to be covered. And I think the committee supported that with strong support. And why would we want to limit that in this case?
Representative Kahn, that was a bill dealing with visiting someone in a hospital. Representative Kahn.
Quite a small financial impact, the idea that someone can visit someone in a hospital as opposed to the full health benefits for a domestic partner.
Further discussion, members. Representative Gottwald.
Mr. Chair, my only point to Representative Kahn's comments about the cost is that this is a policy committee, and I think we kind of said that at the outset. Granted, dollar amounts were brought up earlier, but we've already approved language that expands this. And you can decide whether that's significant or not. But I still attest, in your response to every single amendment offered tonight, your reason for either supporting or opposing it has been whether it equates to marriage or the same provisions for marriage or not. By your own testimony, Representative Kahn, which goes back to my earlier questioning about what the real intent of this bill is. This is a policy committee, so let's talk about the policy.
Further discussion, members. Representative Finstead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kahn, can you tell me where in state statute domestic partner is currently defined?
Representative Kahn.
Domestic partner is not defined in state statute. As far as I know, this would define it.
Okay.
This is the definition of domestic partner.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. So, Mr. Chair, I would move an oral amendment then to delete lines 1.9 through 1.23. And I'd ask for a roll call. And members, it's pretty self-explanatory. I mean, what we're doing here is historic. I mean, we're defining domestic partner in our state statutes. So my amendment then would take that out.
Mr. Chairman, we're obviously doing it for the purpose of health insurance benefits for the state. There are other places in state statutes where we have limited definitions for specific purposes, and so I would oppose the amendment.
Further discussion to the amendment. Roll call has been requested. The clerk.
Mr. Chair, wait. Before we do that, I'm sorry. I thought we asked that earlier. Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, what do you mean by limited definitions and where are they?
I think Representative Emmer, she was saying we define terms in other places in statute when we're using them, like we're using them in Subdivision 1 on the next page. We would define, so we clarify
the. So that hasn't changed. It's still not defined as of right now.
There's it's not defined in law, yes. And she, I don't, good sorry, for clarification. She wasn't making that point, I don't believe. So the clerk will take the roll.
Thiessen.
No.
Anderson.
Yes.
Rod.
Yes.
Bunn.
No.
Emmer.
Yes.
Finston.
Yes.
Gottwald.
Yes.
Huntley.
No.
Liebling.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Murphy.
No.
Norton.
No.
Rood.
No.
Powell.
No.
Chumper.
No.
Walker.
No.
5 ayes, 11 nays. The motion does not prevail. Further discussion to the bill's number, to the bill members.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Member.
I will say first, we'll ask for a roll call on the bill.
Okay.
Since it looks like we've exhausted this issue.
Roll call has been requested.
But we will again, just for the record, note that we are very disappointed. And frankly, it goes beyond disappointment that we are hearing this bill in this legislature after the people that ran their campaigns last fall said that we were not going to be bringing these wedge issues, these emotional issues forward. That was a campaign theme throughout the state of Minnesota. And yet, one of the first things we get to deal with is domestic partnership benefits. And more importantly, it's not the benefits, Mr. Chair. It's creating a new definition. It's something that we know the people, the citizens of the state of Minnesota, do not want. And they haven't asked for it. This committee was faced with votes tonight to go ahead and give the citizens the right to say what marriage is. And it refused to do so. To quote somebody who was here once, it's a sad day in Minnesota when the public is not given the right to address an important emotional wedge issue like this. I hope the folks that were out there campaigning about bread and butter issues that are important to all Minnesotans, like transportation, education, and health care, and not health care that has to do with same-sex marriage or same-sex relationships or homosexual behavior, it has to do with defining domestic partners. That's not what they asked for, Mr. Chairman. And I'm disappointed that this is here, and I hope these folks will all vote against it.
Representative Emmer, and this theme has come up a lot tonight, and I understand that, you know, I understand the reason for that, but I would say that this isn't the first thing that was taken up, first of all. We have done a lot of work, as Representative Broad acknowledged in this committee, related to health care reform. We've taken a lot of time on MPIP, on nursing home COLAs. We spent days and days, weeks and weeks on those issues. We have done bread and butter issues. I think, in addition, off the House floor, this House has passed a renewable energy standard this year already. We're going to be voting on a transportation bill on Saturday earlier than any transportation bill has ever been voted on in the House of Representatives, as far as I know. We've done a lot of bread and butter issues as you define them. But I think that it's fair that we take this issue up as well and give it a hearing, and I think we've given it a good hearing this evening. I'm glad that I think this is actually people were generally very respectful this evening. And so I appreciate that from the committee members, but I think it is time that we go to the vote. So a roll call has been requested.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just asking you, Representative Otremba has an issue that is very important to a number of people related to taxpayer funding of abortions. I'm wondering if you're planning on hearing that bill before deadlines and if she can expect to have a hearing on that issue as well.
No. Representative, the clerk will take the roll.
Thiessen.
Yes.
Anderson.
No.
Rod.
No.
Bunn.
Yes.
Emmer.
No.
Finstead.
No.
Gottwald.
No.
Huntley.
Yes.
Liebling.
Yes.
Loeffler.
Yes.
Murphy.
Yes.
Norton.
Yes.
Rood.
Yes.
Powell.
Yes.
Chumper.
Yes.
Walker.
Yes.
11 ayes, 5 nays. My motion that House File 1618 be recommended pass and re-referred to the Finance Committee as amended has prevailed. We're adjourned, members.